Good luck with that. Hopefully you'll get the answer that you want. I think you will, but I'm not sure about the tax situation. Thank you very much for your calls, texts and tweets this evening. That's it from me, consumer lawyer Dean Dunham. A quick reminder that the advice offered in this hour is for guidance only. You should always seek your own independent legal opinion. I'll be back next Sunday at 9 p.m. with another LBC Consumer Hour. In the meantime, if you missed any of tonight's show, you can listen back on our free Global Player app or the new LBC app, where you can stay up to date with the, with all the latest news and opinion, put your news categories in the order you want, pause and rewind live radio, and listen to a range of podcasts. Download the all-new official LBC app for free from your app store now. Coming up at 1, it's Henry Riley, but next here on LBC, it's Nick Abbott.
Thank you, Dean. A packed program tonight. We will talk about Donald Trump's new tariffs and what that might mean for us. The government is looking to close the disadvantage gap in schools. We'll hear from an inequality lecturer on the proposals. We'll hear about the latest protests in Iran after the violent crackdown that followed the last ones. Cammy Badenoch says the Tories would cut the interest rate on student loans. But should we go much further than that, as the Greens and the Lib Dems suggest? We'll get an update from our US correspondent and hear a weather forecast as a change is on the way. But first, more details about Andrew Windsor, this time concerning his police protection officers, as some say he should be removed from the line of succession. That and more with me, Nick Abbott, after the new news at 10 on LBC.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom. A relative of the man shot dead on Donald Trump's Mar-a-Lago estate after being spotted with a shotgun and fuel can has said the 21-year-old came from a family of the president's political supporters. Austin Tucker Martin had been reported missing earlier in the week. Daniel Lipman is a White House reporter for Politico. He's been telling LBC there are numerous unknown factors.
He came from North Carolina, so you have to wonder, did he drive to Florida? Did he fly? Were there any signs that he was making threats to Trump or any other political actors? And it raises real questions about how this happened again. And you would have thought that they would have tightened the security enough, but evidently they have to ramp it up even more.
The Russian-installed governor in part of Ukraine's Zaporizhia region says power's been restored to most areas after a major attack by Kyiv. They say it was concentrated on the area's energy infrastructure. Oman's foreign minister has confirmed more talks between Washington and Tehran over the Iranian nuclear program are scheduled for this week. They're due to happen in Geneva on Thursday against a backdrop of threats of U.S. military action. But Nega Mortazavi from the Iran podcast has been telling LBC they don't relate to anti-government protests in Iran.
This is more essentially a military leverage used by the U.S. side to bring Iran to the negotiating table and sort of force them to accept the terms of the deal that they want to negotiate on the nuclear issue. I don't really think sort of the concern for the protesters or the freedom to protest is really the main issue for the U.S.
It's thought a fire at a property near a Catholic church in Northamptonshire was started deliberately. It happened in the town of Rushton just before 4 o'clock this morning. Detectives are treating it as a case of arson with intent to endanger life. A man in his 40s has been stabbed to death at Wimbledon in southwest London. A man in his 30s has been arrested on the suspicion of murder. And in sport and in football this evening, Arsenal have extended their lead at the top of the Premier League to 5 points after victory in today's North London Derby. They beat Spurs 4-1, and Liverpool got a dramatic late winner to claim a 1-0 victory against Nottingham Forest. LBC weather, breezy overnight with a mixture of clear spells and showers. Mild, though, with a patchy frost in northern areas. We'll see a low of around about 5 degrees. From Global's newsroom, for LBC, I'm Tim Daly.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Nick Abbott.
Good evening. Metropolitan police officers were apparently ordered to provide security for a celebrity dinner party thrown in Andrew Mountbatten Windsor's honour at Jeffrey Epstein's New York home, newly released emails suggest. Two royal protection officers from Scotland Yard were seemingly told by Epstein's staff to guard the door of the Manhattan townhouse as celebrity guests arrived. at a dinner party held in honour of Andrew in 2010. Well, let's talk about this and the related issues with Jack Royston. Jack is the chief royal correspondent for Newsweek and joins us on the line now. Hello, Jack.
Hello, thanks for having me on.
I appreciate your time. Well, let's talk about the protection officers first. It's now said that they acted as security at a party thrown for Andrew and that they accompanied him to Epstein's Island. I mean, it would have been highly unlikely that any officer would have felt that they could have refused to do any of that, wouldn't it?
Well, particularly going to the island, because if Andrew's going to go there, then somebody's going to need to go with him. But the key bit that I think is particularly humiliating for the Met is the suggestion that the police protection officers were effectively taking orders from Epstein's staff. There may be a set of circumstances under which it was the right thing to do to secure the entrance to the building that a principal is in. But you shouldn't be taking orders to do that from the staff of a, at the time, convicted child abuser. The police protection officers are supposed to be providing an unbeatable level of close protection service to a member of the royal family. And so they should be making their own decisions about how to protect their principal, and they should not be concerning themselves with the needs of the person who runs the building. So that is humiliating. But then also it's the question of what they saw and knew and what testimony they might be able to give to the investigating officers.
But at the time, if Andrew said to them, to his protection officers, just do what these people say, then you wouldn't have expected the police officers to say no, would you?
Well, that's what I think they need to work on, is to establish that sometimes police protection officers must say no. I mean, they're supposed to be the experts on how to protect the principal, and so they ought to have said no. I mean, it's not a huge surprise that they didn't, and it won't come as a surprise to listeners. But this is one thing that I think they have to really crack, is, and not just in relation to the police protection officers, but the palace staff as well. They need to foster a culture within both organisations you can say no to the royals, and that, in fact, at times you must say no to them. And this is one of those circumstances. If the police protection officer, through their training, experience and skills, think that the best way to protect a principal is by guarding the outside of the building and checking everybody who comes in, then if that's what their skill set is telling them to do, that's one thing. But they are not simply the plaything of the royal family member and that royal's friends, and they cannot be put to use in a way that benefits somebody, who not only isn't even a British citizen, isn't a royal family member, but actually was a convicted criminal and child abuser. This is 2010. He'd served his sentence for soliciting prostitution from a 14-year-old girl, Jeffrey Epstein.
Yeah, but when you say that they should foster that sort of relationship, the sort of professional relationship that the officers do what is actually their job, I would imagine that being one of those officers, you would think that your job is actually not what it says on the title, but is just to do whatever the royal concern tells you to do.
And it may well be that's particularly the case in Prince Andrew's case, because he was notoriously very difficult to work for, I think, and had various nicknames which people might have seen going around social media in the last few days. But this is something that the monarchy really needs to crack, and it has to come from the top. It has to come from the king. The king needs to have a word with the whole of the royal family and get everybody on the same page, that the monarchy needs to have values that are clearly stated, and it needs to be made clear to royal family members what standards they're expected to live up to. It needs to be understood by the police protection officers themselves that the royal family members have agreed to meet those values and standards, and that if they fail to do so, there should be a clear system and pathway for officers to express concerns, because they have to change the system to make sure that there isn't another Andrew round the corner, and obviously it's a small family. It's not that I have somebody in mind who might be that person, but when something like this happens, you do have to change the system.
Yeah, you say that the standard should come from the top. Well, it didn't, did it? The late Queen and the current King must have known about how Andrew was towards others. I mean, if I knew, and, you know, much of the country knew what he was like as a person, you know, very rude and superior and high-handed, apparently, then they surely must have known themselves, and yet they didn't do anything about it. I mean, forget about the allegations related to Epstein. He doesn't appear to have been a very nice person. Why was he never corrected?
Yeah. Well, exactly. And actually, you can, the really, really awful stuff, you know, a person only gets there because they got away with every smaller offense along the way. And if you crack down on people for the smaller stuff, then often they don't wind up doing the bigger things at all because they, you know, you breed that culture of expecting to be made accountable. So yes, absolutely. I mean, Andrew was the Queen's blind spot. She, you know, it was always said about the Queen that she never put a foot wrong. But all the times that she did, it was generally related to the family relationships. It wasn't the kind of external public facing stuff. When it comes to how she dealt with the public, she rarely ever put a foot wrong. But when it came to her own family, that is where the problems came. And Andrew was the biggest of all. And yeah, I mean, he was her favorite son, despite being a despicable person. And, you know, we don't know whether he'll be charged with this misconduct in a public office offense. And if he is, we don't know whether he'll be found guilty or whether he'll be acquitted. He could never be charged or he could be put on trial and acquitted. But needless to say, the stories have been coming out for years and years and years, like you say, that he was awful to the staff. That he humiliated Britain by making offensive, crude, and you know, distasteful jokes when he was supposed to be representing Britain as a trade envoy. The list goes on, and somebody needed to get Andrew under control, and they didn't. Even in the 15 years after Virginia first made her allegations against Andrew, they still didn't get him under control. And there have even been stories in the papers just these last few days saying that even when they kicked him out of Royal Lodge in the last sort of couple of months, he was still saying to people, you know, you can't do this to me. I'm the Queen's second son. So, you know, even now he still appears to have that mentality, you know, that mentality and view of himself. So it is very difficult. Part of the root cause of this problem comes from the kind of the blurred line between private and professional life for the royals. So, for example, you know, a person might, you know, another person who's not a royal family member might be respectable in their professional life, and then they might have a private life in which they can be mean or distasteful or make crude jokes or whatever. But there's a clear line between the two. I mean, with Andrew, he got police protection everywhere he went. That included when he was on royal engagements, and it included when he was going about his private life. And I think that there was too much respect for the right of the royals to have a private life, and not enough of a sense that there needs to be some kind of system for reining in royals who are behaving in a way that is morally unconscionable.
Yes, and given all of that, it was pretty morally unconscionable for the government to essentially make that man our top diplomat, a trade envoy.
Well, yes, there needs to be. I mean, there is ample scope here for, at the very least, a parliamentary inquiry, if not a public inquiry, into how, yeah, exactly, how all of this happened, how Andrew managed to get into the position he got into, and exactly what he did let slip in that role to various people. Because, you know, we know what, we know a bit about what Andrew was forwarding on to Epstein from the Epstein files, but the Epstein files only gives us the emails that were sent to Epstein. But some of those emails reference, you know, I'm passing this round my Middle East contacts. You know, those emails that we have make it clear that there are other emails we don't have in which some of the similar kinds of activity were taking place. So, yes, we need to have a clear understanding of how he got that position. You know, we know that the diplomatic corps were not a fan of Andrew, and that, you know, and felt that he was damaging Britain's national interest, not aiding it. So did people escalate that? If so, why was nothing done? Why did it take them so long to take that role away from him? And yeah, why was it not possible to challenge him? And what can the monarchy do to finally get to grips with this idea that actually, if somebody is beyond the pale, there needs to be a clear system for reining them in, so that palace staff and police And, you know, everybody involved knows what the protocol and the system is. Like, what do you do if you're a police protection officer and you're out on a job with a royal family member and they do something that's either illegal or is morally wrong, or, you know, who do you escalate that to? What is your process? And can you have the confidence that you're going to be taken seriously and you're not just going to destroy your own career?
Yes, but, you know, when you talk about this, it's as though we're not talking about individuals who are a member of a family. We're talking about, I don't know, the CEOs of large corporations. That's not what happened here. He was able to get away with behaving like he did because his mother and father allowed him to do it, correct?
That's certainly an element of that. Yeah, I mean, you can approach the same question from two different ways. One is, should the Queen and Philip have stopped him? Answer: yes, they should have done. But you can also ask the secondary question: well, if they're not going to, then what else can you do? You know, are there other systems you can put in place? But I do think that it has to have the support from the top. I think now there does need to be a change in the monarchy, and it does need to be hammered through by Charles.
But he surely is not the person to do it, because he was, at least implicated. Presumably he didn't say anything to him. His mother didn't say anything to him. His father didn't say anything to him. Perhaps none of the other family members said anything to him. So they've all got a certain degree of stain on them, as far as this is concerned, as far as his, behavior, at least to staff members, for instance, is concerned.
Yeah, and, you know, Philip was notoriously short-tempered with staff as well when he wanted to be. I'm not suggesting he did any of the other stuff that Andrew's accused of. But, the Windsors are notoriously short-tempered. They're famous for it.
Why do we revere them?
A lot was tolerated.
Yeah, but why do we revere them so? I mean, they don't appear to be very nice people.
Well, this is the big question that now looms in the wake of this scandal is, do people still revere them? Are people about to lose that reverence? Are we going through a transition now where people, especially the younger generation, are losing that reverence and won't actually view them that way in the future? And when you look at the polling data, there's a huge generational divide, and the positive numbers that you see for the monarchy are largely propped up by the older generation. Mm. People sometimes think that it has always been the case. It's always been that young people didn't like the monarchy. It's not actually true. You know, you go back even to the Diana era, and the numbers, even yes, during the height of their Diana-related unpopularity, the numbers were a lot better than they are today.
But for her specifically, I mean, do you think that people in this country are bullied into having reverence for the royal family? Because I know that there's, in the press, there's a sort of closing of ranks from the establishment, that they're trying to paint Andrew as something that is, you know, out of the ordinary, and it's got nothing to do with the rest of the royal family, and we must support the king, we must support William, and then they're just painting, you know, in pastel shades how wonderful and marvellous the rest of the royal family are. But it doesn't look like that to me.
Well, I think that for many, many years, Republicans have felt bullied into at the very least keeping their views mostly to themselves and not causing a fuss. But I think there was a long period in which Queen Elizabeth II was this completely untouchable figure that nobody could criticize. I think since Charles's reign began, I actually think that some of that has subsided. Not to mention the fact that also the power of the printed press has subsided as well, and things are driven now much more by social media, and social media inherently involves this interaction with other countries. You know, you might go on to a social media platform, X or Instagram or TikTok, and you not only see your fellow countrymen and their opinions, but you might see Americans, you might see Irish people who, you know, even in the wake of the Queen's death, that you know, there were posts by Americans and Irish people which were very anti-monarchy, which were getting huge amounts of engagement. So I think some of that old school control that existed, you know, kind of not literal police control, but, you know, the control of being the majority
of thought,
has eroded. Yes, exactly. Has eroded massively. So I actually don't think, you know, I'm 40 and I grew up in a Britain where there was much more of that. And I don't actually see it currently in the world that we live in today.
Do you think the old arguments for keeping the royal family in the fabulous manner to which they've become accustomed don't work anymore? I mean, royalists usually say that they're vital for tourism. That's the argument I always get. But France gets more tourists than we do. Versailles is far more popular than any royal attraction here. And even compared to other UK attractions, there's nothing with a current royal connection that breaks the top 20 free or paid for tourist spots. And people talk of soft power. You know, we tried that recently with Trump. Didn't get us anywhere. Are we keeping the institution going just because it's always been there and people fear change?
Well, it's actually in some ways super, super simple. We will keep it as long as we like it. And if people change their minds and decide that they don't, then its demise is probably inevitable. But it takes, like I said, I think we might be basically going through a transition period, which will take decades. You know, it might take a couple of decades to happen. But you can make all these arguments about the economy. Is it good for the economy or bad for the economy? But, you know, we did Brexit, and that's proved to be spectacularly terrible for the economy. So it's not actually the reason. You know, you can make all of those arguments. They're rhetorical, but they're not the reason we have the monarchy. The reason we have the monarchy is because a majority of people like it. But that's what's happened. That's why it's so important to watch the polling numbers, because they have actually been changing since the 1980s. It's a really, really slow change that has kind of accelerated in pace, probably over the last kind of 6 years. But it's and it is complex. But basically, back in the 1980s, we were a hardcore monarchist country. Upwards of about 60% of the British public felt it was very important that we were a monarchy. The collapse of Charles and Diana's marriage dissolves that hardcore monarchist position, but we remained a broadly pro-monarchy country, but in a softer way. Instead of people thinking it was very important, they thought it was fairly important. But it is only actually in the last kind of 6 years that we've seen the number, the percentage of people who would actually say that they would vote to abolish the monarchy start to rise. So if the 90s saw the disintegration of the hardcore monarchist position, then the 2020s is seeing those soft royalists turn into potentially Republicans.
Yes, as the elder of our numbers fall off the end of life's conveyor belts, then the royal family is just, it looks likely to become less and less relevant and less popular.
Well, it's potentially even actually a little worse than that for the palace, because what appears to be, there was something called the Social Attitude Survey back in, I think it was September that it came out, which appeared to indicate that actually even beyond people aging, the disaffection with monarchy is actually spreading up the age range faster than people are aging. So it's not simply that Gen Z are aging out of being in their 20s and are starting to hit their 30s. It is, you know, the numbers are getting worse even among, you know, millennials, and older Brits are starting to adopt the attitude that younger Brits have. Right. So it's now really, it's only really when you get above 50 that you have a really definitive demographic that is actually, you know, strikingly pro-monarchy. Whereas anything below 50, you know, the kind of 35 to 45 range is kind of like, oh yeah, you know, maybe hit and miss, could wind up 50-50, you know, depends on which poll you read. Whereas, you know, which is really worrying for the monarchy, because they were a shoo-in in that demographic group previously. You know, even in the aftermath of the Oprah interview, they were still pretty solid within that age group. Whereas now it's starting to look much more shaky. It's really only when you get over the age of 50 that people are definitively pro-monarchy.
And definitively pro-Brexit and pro-reform UK. Interesting that the demographics are the same. Good to talk to you, Jack. Thanks so much for that. Jack Royston, Chief Royal Correspondent for Newsweek. Well, the revelations keep dribbling out. What do you think a good outcome from all this would look like? 0345 6060 973 LBC.
Weekdays from 7 a.m.
This is Taxation Without Representation.
Straight to the point.
You get giddy with all these in the morning, really, isn't it?
Listen on our free Global Player app or the LBC app. Download it now from your app store. LBC.
Hey, dogs. Yeah, I'm talking to you. If you're tired of dry, tasteless kibble or slop that plops out of a tin, you're going to want to hear this. Butternut Box makes only the freshest dog food with juicy meat and tender veg. It's the kind of food that makes dogs tongue out, running around the kitchen happy. Let's hope your human heard this too. Butternut Box. Fresh food, happy dogs. Try Butternut Box today and get 25% off your first two boxes. Offer available online in the UK and Ireland to first-time customers only.
We asked patients at Great Ormond Street Hospital what makes someone special.
They can make me laugh lots and lots and lots and lots.
They have to like arts and crafts.
Their favourite food is chocolate cake.
They might be a magician, so they can magically make me better.
They will be kind.
Does that sound like you? Be someone special and leave a gift in your will to Gosh Charity. Search Gosh Legacy for your Gifts in Wills guide.
Thank you.
People ask me, what's my good place? Sunday lunch with the whole family. And knowing that because I'm over 55, I can withdraw from my pension pot with a few taps on the Pension Bee app. Ollie, are you feeding the dog?
No.
At Pension Bee, we believe that when your pension is in a good place, you're in a good place. Download the Pension Bee app and be pension confident. When investing, your capital is at risk. Withdrawals available from the age of 55, 57 from 2028.
This is LBC with Nick Abbott. Call 0345 6060 973. Text 84850. Alexa, send a comment to LBC.
Yeah, so these revelations, they keep dribbling out, and it's not getting any better, is it? It's just, it's like being dipped in manure. And now we hear that his royal protection officers were seemingly told by Jeffrey Epstein's staff to essentially be doormen to his Manhattan townhouse as they had a celebrity party at Jeffrey Epstein's place for Andrew Mountbatten Windsor. And being doormen is really not their job. They also apparently accompanied him to Jeffrey Epstein's island. Well, you can understand why it would be difficult for somebody who is a royal protection officer to say, no, I am not going to first do what you just asked, and I'm not going to let you do what you clearly intend to. They just wouldn't do that, would they? Any more than somebody in Donald Trump's orbit would tell him no for fear of the reaction they might receive. But, of course, just because they went to the island, just because they went to that Manhattan townhouse and, you know, accompanied Andrew when he was meeting Jeffrey Epstein, doesn't mean to say that they saw anything, that they had any clue as to what was going on. You would think that other members of the royal family might have had some idea, and they certainly knew about his behaviour to the staff, which doesn't say anything positive about, certainly about him, and doesn't really say anything positive about them. Or us, actually, because this country has sort of tied its reputation and its image so much to the royal family that it's now become, well, I mean, at best, something of an international laughingstock. So what do you think a good outcome to any of this is going to be? What would it look like? And what do you make of this talk about removing him from the line of succession? I mean, that's just a bit silly, isn't it? That's doing something to appear to be doing something. I mean, in what parallel universe could he ever be our king? Paisley, hello, Will.
Hi there, Nick. We should have moved to a ceremonial monarchy after Edward VIII. You know, that was the big crunch moment.
What would the difference be to a ceremonial monarchy and what we've got now?
Well, the difference is, can you tell me what happened in the last Privy Council meeting?
No.
Nobody can unless you were actually in it. And we're giving diplomatic boxes to people in hereditary family with, you know, sensitive information and state secrets. To people in a hereditary family. The monarch owns a seabed given to him by God. You know, this is...
He owns whatever you might find under your feet at the moment, whether you think you own the land or not.
Yeah, there's just... Why do you think the civil list is so large? It's just to pack as many people into the treehouse as possible to support the treehouse. You know, there's too many people were invested in their own titles or wanting a title, because obviously it's a stay out of jail free card, you know, because Mandelson and Moen are still walking about. They've committed crimes, you know, they've not been arrested because they've still got titles. Jimmy Savile went to his grave, and it was only when he was dead that the news came out about what he was up to.
Right, but well, I don't think anybody really had any idea about Jimmy.
Plenty of people at the BBC did.
Well, I'm not sure that that's true, that they actually knew the extent of his depravity. I find it hard to believe that anybody at the BBC had an idea of quite the extent of his crimes. I mean, they might have thought that he was a bit off. I mean, I did, as a child, looking at... Jim will fix it. It always looked a bit weird to me, but that doesn't mean to say that I actually had any idea about what it was that he was doing. But interesting thoughts. Thanks for that, Will. What do you think of that we should have moved to some sort of ceremonial monarchy? Or is that just another step on a sort of an endless staircase of sort of salami slicing it? I mean, we either have it as it is now with all the pomp and the vast amounts of money that gets spent on it, and you know, all the and putting them on pedestals essentially as some sort of family sent to us by God, or we just don't have anything at all. Most countries don't have anything at all, and they seem to be working perfectly well. As I said at the beginning of this, the Palace of Versailles gets way more tourist visits than any royal palace or attraction in this country, and the French had a pretty strict policy about their royal family. 0345 6060 973. What do you think a good outcome for both this country and the royal family would look like from everything that's sort of swirling around now, everything that you know about what's happened? What would a good outcome look like? 0345 6060 973. More of your calls on this to come, but immediately after this news break, we're going to be talking about what is going on in Iran. 10:30 on LBC, the news headlines with Tim Daly.
A relative of the man shot dead on Donald Trump's Mar-a-Lago estate after being spotted with a shotgun and fuel can has said the 21-year-old came from a family of the president's political supporters. Austin Tucker Martin had been reported missing earlier in the week. Reform UK says it will impose a visa freeze on Pakistan, Afghanistan and Syria if the three nations refuse to take back illegal immigrants. The party's new Home Affairs spokesman, Zia Yusuf, is expected to make the announcement concerning people with no legal right to be in the UK. And it's thought a fire at a property near a Catholic church in Northamptonshire was started deliberately. It happened in the town of Rushton just before 4 o'clock this morning. LBC weather, breezy overnight with a mixture of clear spells and showers, mild with a patchy frost in northern areas, lows of around 5 degrees.
This is LBC.
When it comes to retirement advice, the last thing you want is to be put in a bucket. Seen as this type of person, or that type of person. At Fisher Investments UK, we never put you in a bucket. We always tailor retirement advice that's just right for you. Fisher Investments UK, retirement advice that's as individual as you are. Learn more at fisherinvestments.co.uk. Investing involves the risk of loss. Fisher Investments UK is regulated by the UK Financial Conduct Authority.
Big motoring world are big on choice. But what does that mean for you? Well, we have thousands of cars in stock. So let's say you want a Mini, an electric one, in black, with a panoramic roof, Apple CarPlay, heated leather seats, rear view camera. Yep, there it is. Being big means we're more likely to have the right car for you. Big Motoring World, we're big on choice. See website for nearest store. Big, big,
big Shine Night Walk London is a 10K, half marathon or full marathon supported walk around the city at night on the 19th of September to raise vital money for Cancer Research UK. It's also...
everyone walking with all their colours, twinkling away.
We can actually see how nice London is. And London is different at night time.
Celebration of life, and it gives hope.
Step towards a brighter future at shinewalk.org today to get 30% off your entry. Together, we are beating cancer. T's and C's apply.
Nick Abbott on LBC. Call 0345 6060 973.
So, more of your thoughts on the travails of the royal family, about Andrew in particular, and what you think might be a positive outcome out of all this. I mean, is there anything that anybody could do, both within and without the royal family, to actually make this not necessarily go away, but just look a little bit more positive and reflect more positively on us as a country than it does at the moment? And do you think that the removing him from the line of succession is actually a thing, or is that just something that people have thought of in want of thinking of something that's actually, you know, substantive. We'll come to that in a moment. Your calls on 0345 6060 973. But let's talk about Iran. Students from several Iranian universities have staged anti-government protests for the first time since last month's deadly crackdown. Footage from yesterday shows hundreds of demonstrators peacefully marching on campus at the Sharif University of Technology in the capital of Tehran. Halle Blake is the British-Iranian activist and co-founder of United for Massa, and she joins us on the line now. Hello, Halle.
Hi, Nick.
Thanks very much for your time. The fight back by the regime to the protests last month was so violent and deadly. Are you surprised that anybody is continuing to protest there?
No, I'm not surprised at all. What we heard was that obviously people were mourning their friends, their classmates, and their families. But the feeling on the ground was very much that they will come out again, that they will fight, that they will continue to fight, whether we get help or not. The help will obviously reduce the number of bloodsheds of Iranians and limit the crackdowns that they'll receive. But I'm not surprised to see this at all. We could see this coming.
But the help that you are talking about might be from Donald Trump. He promised Iranians that he would have their back. Help is on the way. And then he didn't. He didn't do anything. And now Trump is saying that he's going to strike against the regime again. But, you know, opposition groups in Iran can't rely on anything he says, can they?
That's true. I mean, to be fair, it's very unclear what President Trump will finally do. He has moved quite a lot of equipment and vessels to the region, but we don't know what would be the action. But of course, what we are asking for are very clear strikes, and to really deliver on his words, we do feel that Trump will do something, but the extent of that is unclear at this point. But of course, people trusted his words when they came out. They didn't come out just because of him. They came out for democracy and they came out for freedom. But 40,000 Iranians didn't die for a nuclear deal. So all these negotiations over these dead bodies are seen as a we look down on these negotiations. These negotiations only legitimize the regime further. And people will continue to come out. People will continue to get killed. The killing and the torture hasn't stopped. This week they have executed an 18-year-old, and we're hearing more disappearances from across all ages, to be honest, and all walks of life. So it's just a matter of what that help would be and how quickly they can get to Iran.
Yeah, what do you know about Iran's nuclear facilities? Because Donald Trump led an attack on them last summer. He said it had completely and totally obliterated Iran's nuclear enrichment facilities. And now he says Iran has 10 days to stop their nuclear enrichment program. So was it obliterated or not?
Well, I'm not a nuclear scientist, so I can't give you all that in detail. I think the truth is probably somewhere in between. That will be my suggestion. And obviously, there must have been sites that were not known, perhaps. But I all these nuclear deals over 40,000 dead bodies seems to be not relevant to us.
Yeah.
How many more people need to die to know that you cannot deal with this regime, that this regime must not be legitimized, that the West needs to engage with a transition, in discussion and engagement with a democratic transition, such as Crown Prince Reza Pahlavi, to transit to a democratic Iran. So, these nuclear talks are just beyond us at this point.
Yeah, the regime are not going to want to even consider transferring to a democratic system, are they? I mean, many people in and outside Iran want regime change, but can that be achieved by aerial bombardment?
It will enable the people taking over. We want to be the ones that finish off this regime entirely. But it will equalize the game. As we saw in January, people were met, with machine guns and weapons, fit for a war with a foreign nation, but the people were met with it. So it's not a fair field. And people need to equalize it somehow, and they see that in an intervention format coming from the outside. We have seen successful interventions in the global history in the past, where it's been really successful and it allowed for the freedom of nations. We don't think this regime will be voted out. We have tried voting per se, but this isn't something that works with this regime at all. They only know, I'd say they only know one language, and that's violence.
If there was a regime change, would things necessarily get better for Iranians? Because America has led regime change in the region many times before. It's not gone smoothly in the past. Iran, Iraq, a couple of times, Libya, Afghanistan, Syria, Yemen. So it's all ended in instability and humanitarian crisis and bloodshed.
So it's interesting you say this. Iran's really different, especially where we are in history right now. Iran has actually led a lot of historical changes in the Middle East, and it's a really important country to change in the region. Iran will not be Libya or Iraq, because we have, the people are united. We're in the middle of a revolution. There is a clear plan under the Iran Prosperity Project. Millions came out last weekend globally in support of Reza Pahlavi's call, and millions came out on the 8th and 9th of January in support of his call. So we are in the middle of a revolution. We have all the right elements to get this over the line and not allow it to become those countries. But also, let's not forget the reason Iraq is the way it is. It's because of the intervention of the Islamic Republic into those countries at the same time. So with the regime, if you see the end of this regime, we'll actually see more prosperity across the region in other countries who've really struggled to become prosperous. So I think Iran will not be Iraq. We have a completely different history, and a different, I'd say a different population as well. We have a highly educated population that are united and wants to get to that democratic change.
Well, you said the word united a couple of times in relation to the population of Iran united against the current regime. But there's footage from yesterday of both the students demonstrating against the regime, but also of pro-government rallies. So how much support do you think the government actually enjoys?
It's very little. And these Basiji militias are often paid. Sometimes they are student Basijis. They get allocated spaces at university, so they actually bypass the exams, for example, at university. So they might look like they are bold. They're actually not that much in terms of numbers when you compare. And as you saw, they actually started the violence as well. So you can imagine that their ideology is always at the forefront of their fight. But the regime doesn't actually have major support right now. As we saw in January, people as young as 2 years old, their families were out on the streets alongside their grandmothers. So that's the extent of this change. And also people from all walks of life, all ethnicities, all religions are all coming out. So that's why this is really, really different, and the support is not very much at all. Once we get to democratic ballot boxes, you will see how different this is.
Now, the protests started, at least in part, over frustration regarding the economy. Apart from the events that we've talked about, what is life like in Iran now?
Look, every aspect of life is controlled under this dictatorship, from, going to university to your daily life, from what you wear, how you conduct yourself, And people right now are being prosecuted and disappearing without almost any grounds. There are phone checking stations across the city. I mean, it's a totalitarian regime. So there is not much life. It's more like death right now. So and the people are well educated. I would say well established, secular, democratic, and they want to partner with the world. They want to partner and mix into the world, and that's what they're fighting for. They're fighting for that chance.
What about the economy? People's ability to actually buy, you know, the essentials.
Correct. This is really a difficult topic. Being the one of the richest countries on Earth by resources, so it's 10 times resources per capita. You would struggle to hear that a working person is unable to buy meat. I've had accounts received from people who haven't been able to even afford the basic needs that they have. So for years, and that's what this regime has done. It's not invested in the economy. It's not invested in infrastructure. There's mismanagement, there is corruption and fraud, and as we see, their elite and oligarchs are living in million-pound houses in the UK. For example, Ali Ansari's got properties over 300 million euros across Europe, for example, and also in the UK. So these are this is an oligarch and elitist mafia that we are dealing with, and they're keeping people poor. So it's very difficult. And of course, sanctions have had effects on the economy. But the reason we have the sanctions is because of the hostility and the terrorism this regime has carried out globally. And that's mainly been by the IRGC. And that's why we've actually been asking the UK government to proscribe the IRGC. And actually, UK is the last one who hasn't proscribed the IRGC, and all of its allies have. So the economy itself, it's terrible. People are struggling, and it will not change until we see a democratic Iran that's working for Iran and working for Iranian people.
Very good to talk to you, Halle. Thanks so much for your time. That's Halle Blake, British-Iranian activist, co-founder of United for Massa. Now, we're going to take a short break and then come back with more of your thoughts on the travails of the royal family, particularly concerning Andrew, but none of it reflects very well on them, on all of them, and by extension, none of it reflects very well on us as a country. So what could be a positive outcome from all of this? 0345 6060 973.
Nick Ferrari at breakfast on LBC.
A prime minister in office, but not in power.
There's only now a matter of when he goes, not if he goes.
A government that's a bit of a joke and falling flat.
Chancellor, I've got something for you. Happy Pancake Day.
Thank you very much, Prime Minister.
But if the government loses a crucial by-election in Gorton and Denton next week...
What we all need to do now is drive the pace of change. That means greater unity.
Is it time to handy over to Andy?
Nick Ferrari at breakfast. Back tomorrow morning from 7. Listen on our free Global Player app or the LBC app.
When you're smiling.
Banning Dental Group Clinics with over 5,000 top-rated Google reviews. Keep on smiling.
This time last year, Hassan was working in sales and spent his evenings gaming. Now, he's working as a prison officer.
You know what's going to happen. It's not worth it. Let's just go in there.
He's tackled cell fires, got through to some of the most challenging prisoners, and helped support their rehabilitation. He's done things he once thought he was never capable of, but he still loves his gaming. An extraordinary job done by someone like you. Search prison jobs now.
Get extra support with Immunace multivitamins with vitamin D, zinc and selenium, which contribute to the normal function of the immune system. Immunace from Vitabiotics, the UK's number one vitamin company. Verification at vitabiotics.com. from Boots, pharmacies and vitabiotics.com.
Chase is the digital bank that boosts your savings to 4.5% AER variable.
A boost?
Yep. It includes a 2.25% AER boost for the first 12 months.
Are they being boosted now?
All the time. Bedtime, gym time, romantic dinner time. And soon you could boost your way to...
Beach time.
Boost your savings with Chase. Search Chase Boosted Saver. 18 plus UK residents available to new Chase current account customers for their first 31 days. 4.41% gross interest paid monthly. Eligibility and T's and C's apply.
Here at Southeastern, we know a bit of good news goes a long way, however big or small it may be. So we wanted to let you know that we're continuing to make improvements across our network. From sprucing up our trains and many of our stations to make your journey nicer, to improving the network to minimise delays, we're investing in making your journey with us better, one step at a time. Find out more at southeasternrailway.co.uk/betterjourneys.
Nick Abbott on LBC. Call 0345 6060 973.
Yes, so we're talking about the continuing saga of Andrew, once formerly known as Prince, and the latest revelations concern the Metropolitan Police officers who were providing security for him, who were then used as doormen, essentially, to a celebrity party that was thrown in his honour by Jeffrey Epstein at his New York home. They also apparently accompanied him to that infamous island. Simon in Canterbury says, I'm not defending Andrew in any way, but merely commenting that he hasn't been, that he hasn't actually been charged with anything yet. It's not a crime to be pompous and arrogant. Yes, but it's not a good look for a country to put somebody who is pompous and arrogant on a plinth and revere them, because that makes us look as though pompousness and arrogance is something that we approve of. And we kind of do, really. I mean, we're still such a cap-doffing nation. Bordeaux. Hello, Dave.
Good evening, Nick. How are you?
Good, thanks.
I was talking to one of your colleagues. I'm not often sort of feel the need to phone up on many subjects, but I've been a Republican for as long as I can remember, and it suddenly feels like we've turned a corner somewhat, in the sense that people are having a debate that just never used to exist. Very, very rarely would you hear on the radio or the television people even questioning the fact that the UK has a monarchy. Mm. And although I have friends in Australia and friends in Canada, I'm really curious about why other Commonwealth countries continue to put up with what is quite frankly an embarrassing head of state. An embarrassing family representing their countries as well. I can just about get my head around Britain, England especially, out of all of the countries of the UK, continuing to put up with it. But I cannot really fathom why all of these other Commonwealth countries, Australia especially, in Canada, continuing to put up with it.
I think partly it's just the human beings' reluctance or resistance to change.
Completely. And I think also the idea that having sort of been anti-monarchy for a long time, there is, to a certain degree, you do feel like, oh, it's just me. Maybe it's me that just feels this way. And then you sort of forget about it a bit. But now something's suddenly happened, and it's happened very much so in the last week. And I think all the PR in the world isn't going to help the royal family, because as you rightly pointed out earlier in your programme, your guest did, there's a tidal shift, and it's spreading through young people into people a bit older like myself. I'm nearly 50, and I've got no love for them at all. And if it's starting to change the minds of people who are a little bit older, then they've got a problem. There's a big, big problem coming down the line for the royal family, and I genuinely cannot see how they're going to survive, not least because I don't think we've seen anything yet. I think we're going to have months, if not years, of scandals unfolding in relation to this family.
Well, I would be surprised if that were not the case. I guess we'll know when we know. Thanks for that, David. 0345 6060 973. Peter said, Who would lose if Britain abolished the monarchy? The royal family would still be wealthy, famous celebrities if they chose to be. Monarchists could still enjoy following them. The nation would be free of the costs and the royals would be free of obligation. Yeah, but they wouldn't, though, would they? I mean, we wouldn't... even if we did abolish the monarchy, they would still be who they are, with all the history that goes with that. I'm not sure it would make any difference. They would still reflect on us as their actions, both present and past, would still reflect on us as a nation. Stratford-upon-Avon. Hello, Jane.
Hello, Nick.
Jane.
Hi. Well, first of all, I'm definitively over 50 by a long, 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 long way. I don't think we can have a revolution in this country. British people are not revolutionary. But I think we could cut back on what we do for the royal family. I find it is absolutely astonishing that within a mile or within half a mile, there's Buckingham Palace, St. James's Palace, Parents' House, Kensington Palace. Why on earth do they need all of that? They've got more money than the rest of the world put together. And only half a mile walking from those places, there are people sleeping on tents in the streets. Mm-hmm. It's obscene. And this notion that you're going to curtsy and bow to them, why? They're just people. I hate that aspect. And I think it makes us sort of very backward. It's such a feudal system. How did they all get, you know, all these lords and ladies that got all these stately homes all over the place? They got them because a few hundred years ago, they're all fighting on horseback. And the king of the day says, oh, well done, old chap. There you go, you can have that county. Oh, we'll call it Gloucestershire. Yeah, that's how it, you know, it's not, and we're all going, well, not me. Oh, thank God, no, not really people that I'm close to. The people are dying and scraping. I remember when I was quite young, seeing people, old ladies standing outside in the rain, mm-hmm. holding teddy bears and knitting matinee jackets for somebody's baby.
Yes, it's almost as though that we've been hypnotised. I think the constant diet of propaganda, I mean, they are, if nothing else, fabulous for the press because it's just a never-ending story.
Well,
I think that, yes, of course. I think that it's the nature of being subsumed in these stories and tales of deference and, you know, insistence that they are sort of born to this and are somehow superior. And it's just,
I absolutely loathe that aspect of it all. But I'll tell you something. This is, obviously, I won't know. When they were talking about Andrew being taken into the police for questioning the other day, and, oh, they're all saying, oh, is he in a police cell? I can bet you bottom dollar he was in no police cell. He's probably sitting in a very, very comfortable sofa somewhere with somebody obsequious saying, would you like a cup of coffee, sir? Can I get you a cold drink, sir?
Well, we're led to believe that... I was thinking the exact same thing, but we're led to believe that that is not the case. But good to talk to you, Jane. Thanks for that. Wayne says, I'm 55, which is old. I guess is old, he says. I've never had any respect for the monarchy and can't recall anyone I know my age being any different. Sarah says, in my late 30s, me and my family and friends sometimes forget they even exist. I think they're a waste of time and money. Well, you know, I've been talking about, on air, talking about the royal family for decades, and I can't remember such a tidal wave, might be overstretching it, but a current of dissatisfaction, I'll put it mildly, to them. And it's not just really about Andrew, but I think Andrew is the sort of wedge that is opening the door for people's ire. Harrow, hello, Bob.
Hi, good evening, Nick, and good evening to your listeners. I just briefly want to say I'm 58 years old. I served in the British Army. And King Charles was the Colonel-in-Chief of the regiment I served in, the Parachute Regiment. I've been a royalist all of my life, and after I served in the Army, I got qualifications from the Royal College of Surgeons. In the past week, Nick and your listeners, I feel that I have been mugged by reality. And my faith and confidence in the royal family has been shaken to its very core. And I think now that if we are to have a good outcome for the royal family, we have to be absolutely stripped back to the bare essentials, and every member of the royal family moving forward must be above and beyond reproach.
But isn't stripping them back to their barest essentials, doesn't that kill the whole point of having a royal family? I mean, having the royal family, still a thing in this country, it's all about the pomp and the circumstance and the men on horseback with silly hats and, you know, all that jazz. Otherwise, what's the point of having them at all?
Good point, Nick. Having served in the parachute regiment, we had very little respect for the silly men in their crap hats on horseback. But we need one royal family, and that would be William and Catherine. Right. The rest can go and work. And if they are above reproach, that's one royal family. I mean, in Spain, they've got a royal family. And when they had the floods in the south of Spain, King Felipe stood there and he literally, actually, not metaphorically, took it on the chin when his people remonstrated with him. Mm. And that drew the love and respect. Now, if the royal family can do that and take it on the chin, I will then try to rebuild the respect and confidence in one family, sir.
Okay, good to talk to you, Bob. I'll give you the last word on that. There'll be plenty of opportunities to talk about this subject on LBC to come. Now, we're going to change the subject. After the news, Tory leader Kemi Badenoch had vowed to slash the amount of interest graduates pay on their student loan debts. Under the Tories' proposed reforms, graduates on Plan 2 loans, that's those who studied between 2012 and 2023, would see the amount added to their debt each month cut, thanks to a reduced interest rate. If you're a student who's saddled with this regressive debt, do you think that this is a good idea? Is it even remotely going far enough? Do you believe that something needs to change to tackle this system of student debt? 0345 6060 973. Friday, Saturday, Sunday night at 10. Nick Abbott, LBC.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation. This is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 11 o'clock. Mainstream schools are to get extra funding to support children with special educational needs and disabilities. The measures will be part of a £4 billion package to make them more inclusive as part of a new white paper on education being published tomorrow. The Conservatives have expressed concerns, but the Education Secretary Bridget Phillipson has already told LBC the current system can't continue.
We're spending a fortune and the outcomes and the quality of the education is really, really very variable. We see it both here in terms of specialist provision in education, but we also see it in children's social care, where private equity have come in and are seeing this as a convenient revenue stream when we're talking about often some very vulnerable children.
An armed man's been shot dead after breaching the perimeter of Donald Trump's Mar-a-Lago residence in Florida. He's being named as Austin Tucker Martin. The authorities say he was carrying a shotgun and a fuel can. Reform UK says it will impose a visa freeze on Pakistan, Afghanistan and Syria if they won't take back illegal immigrants. The party's new Home Affairs spokesman is expected to make an announcement concerning people with no legal right to stay in the UK. Okay. More now from LBC's George Ellison.
Zia Yusuf is due to say Reform's new policy will also apply to Eritrea, Sudan and Somalia during a speech scheduled for tomorrow in Dover. It's expected to focus on what are being called immigration, policing, national security frameworks and cultural preservation. Reform also say costings will be set out during the event. Home Secretary Shabana Mahmood has already threatened to block UK visas for people from some African countries if they don't cooperate over deportees.
The Mexican army says it's killed the leader of a significant drugs cartel. The Jalisco New Generation Group is known for trafficking huge quantities of fentanyl and other narcotics to the United States. Journalist Adam Hancock, who's in Mexico, says El Mencho's cartel is extremely dangerous.
They really spread out from Jalisco State across the whole country, generating billions of dollars of income. But a sense of how powerful they are has also been seen today in the reaction that we've had, in particular in Jalisco State, where there have been been people out on the streets, gunmen out on the streets, cars being burned, blockades being set up.
And in sport, the president of the International Olympic Committee, Kirsty Coventry, has paid tribute to a new kind of winter games at the close of this year's event. Team GB finished with a record equaling 5 medals. LBC weather, breezy overnight with a mixture of clear spells and showers, mild with a patchy frost in northern areas, lows typically of around 5 degrees. From Global's newsroom, for LBC, I'm Tim Daly.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Nick Abbott.
Kemi Badenoch has vowed to slash the amount of interest that graduates pay on their student loan debts. Under the Tories' proposed reforms, graduates on what are called Plan 2 loans, those who study between 2012 and 2023, will see the amount that's added to their debt each month cut thanks to a new reduced interest rate. That is, the interest rate would change from the retail price index, plus 3%, to the CPI, the consumer price index, which is a lower value. Well, let's talk about this with Tom Allingham. Tom is Communications Director at Save the Student and the UK's largest student money website. Hello, Tom.
Hello, yeah, thank you for having me.
Appreciate your time. Adding any interest, let alone retail price index, plus 3% compound interest to a student loan, looks like the government are loan sharks. What does this actually mean in practice for the students?
Yes, and it's interesting you use the phrase loan sharks, because that is something that a lot of graduates have been saying themselves. What it actually means for graduates is that even if they are repaying hundreds or even thousands of pounds a year on their student loans, in many cases they're actually not seeing their balances decrease because the interest rates have been so high. So I think at the moment, a graduate needs to be earning an average of £66,000 a year to actually be repaying more than is being added in interest each year.
Right, and if they don't earn that amount, then what happens to their debt?
So if you're earning less than £66,000 a year, then on average, that means that your balance will be increasing. Now, the one really crucial thing to note is that the interest rate, while it does affect the overall level of debt, doesn't affect the amount you repay each month. That's only affected by what you earn. So you repay 9% of your earnings over a threshold, which is currently £28,500 a year. But this current government has said that they will freeze that for 3 years, and that will be the thing that increases the monthly repayments that graduates are having to make.
Right, it's a regressive tax, isn't it? It penalises the poor and the less well-off. If you're from a rich family, you either wouldn't need a loan in the first place, or you could pay it off quickly. Only those who can't afford to do that are stung with this extra interest. It's the opposite of levelling up, isn't it?
Well, I would agree with you on that, yeah. I think some defenders of the system would say that the repayment system is progressive because the higher rates of interest are charged to higher earners, which in effect should mean that higher earners end up repaying more. But for a few reasons that doesn't end up happening, not least because the very highest earners can repay their loans before as much interest accrues. But as you've pointed out, people from the richest backgrounds don't have to take out student loans in the first place, so they can pay their costs up front with no interest added at all. It's people from every other kind of background, middle and low income, who are having to take out student loans and who are paying interest on top of it.
Yes, and the Tories have inserted themselves into this and said that they are going to look at least, cutting the amount of interest that graduates pay by changing the interest rate from RPI, the Retail Prices Index, to CPI, which is a consumer prices index. Now, the CPI is lower usually by a couple of points, isn't it? Do you think that is actually the argument that we should be having, or should we actually be thinking bigger than that?
I think this is the perfect opportunity to think bigger than that. I think, any changes that can be made in the short to medium term that will benefit graduates are fantastic. But we as an organization have always been against tuition fees. And I think a lot of people are now starting to ask the question, are tuition fees actually a effective way of financing the university system? So I think, given in the 8 or so years that I've been doing this job, this is the most sustained momentum that there's ever been around a student finance or graduate finance story, that actually we should take this opportunity to have those wider discussions about how the system works.
And is any party actually addressing that, or are they all just tinkering at the edges?
Tinkering is the word I would use for the majority of the parties. I think the Green Party have probably kind of come forward with the most radical changes. So they, for instance, do want to abolish tuition fees. And recently, the other day, Zach Polansky said that he would like to have, in his words, a conversation about abolishing some level of student debt. Now, where that conversation goes, I don't know, but it certainly seems that the Green Party are thinking the most radically on this topic.
Yeah, our competitor nations, Germany, Norway, Finland, Sweden, Denmark, you know, where the happy people live, they all have free higher education. Most of the countries in Europe have either free or a higher education at a very minimal rate. So why do they value it so highly, higher education, and we don't?
It's a very good question, and I have to be honest and say I don't know why we don't, because I think there is a lot to be gained from having free tuition. I think, you know, as a principle, I think it's morally right, in my opinion, that people shouldn't be charged, particularly not the level of tuition fees that we have in this country. But I think it's to everyone's benefit that we have a well-educated population and that people can access university at no cost at all. So why we don't value it as highly in this country, I don't know, but we should do, in my opinion.
Of course, when we were in the European Union, students from this country could go and study in EU countries for free or very minimal fees. That was a freedom that was taken away from them, wasn't it?
It was. I do believe we are rejoining Erasmus very soon. In the next few years, I think that has been agreed upon. So that, you know, that privilege will be extended to future generations. But obviously, there is a big chunk of students in between, in the time between us leaving the European Union and that scheme being reintroduced, who didn't get to take advantage of that.
Tony Blair changed us from being a country where you could go to university for free. In fact, it was better than that. Students might not like to hear it, but not only was tuition free, but they used to pay you to go. His aim, Tony Blair's aim, was that 50% of us would go to university and it should cost us $9,000 a year. So we went from fewer people going and getting free tuition to more people going and it costing a vast amount. Did Tony Blair actually ruin a system that was working perfectly well?
I mean, that's a very big question. I think it has been posited by quite a few people that in expanding access to higher education, so taking it from, you know, less than 10% of young people going to, you know, near 50%, has required changes to the funding system, and that a small level of tuition fee was necessary. Again, this is, you know, opinion rather than fact, but a small level of tuition fee was necessary in order to expand access to higher education. What I would say, though, is that the kind of arbitrary goal of sending 50% of young people to university, as much as, you know, I'm a big fan of university, I can extol the virtues of it for a long time, I wouldn't necessarily say that you should just go to university because you've been told it's the right thing to do. If you think there are other forms of other paths, rather, in life that you think are worth taking, that you think can get you to where you want to do, where you want to be, rather, then those are absolutely worth taking. And you shouldn't just go to university because you're told it's the only way to get success in life.
Do you think it's fair that all courses are charged the same? Because, I mean, somebody reading English, for instance, needs little provided for them. Somebody doing mechanical engineering, on the other hand, needs whole buildings full of humming machinery.
Again, I can definitely see that argument, but I think it's a slippery slope to go down. With regards to, so let's say, for instance, you charge £9,000 a year for medicine, but you only charged £3,000 a year for English because you're saying that, you know, English costs less to run in that respect. I think the danger there is that the people from kind of lower income backgrounds who are more debt averse, and there are studies to show this, that people from lower income backgrounds are more debt averse, less likely to go to university because of the prospect of debt. If suddenly we're saying to them, well, you can study English for £3,000, medicine's going to cost you £9,000, so that actually it might end up putting off people from lower income backgrounds going on to courses like medicine that, you know, may have higher income potential in the future but would cost more up front.
Well, so do you think it should be the other way around? Then perhaps people who are doing medicine, other studies, other subjects that we need, like engineering, AI and so on, do you think that those courses should be subsidised?
I think the fairer system would be one where all courses cost the same. You know, ideally nothing, as I say, that there would be no tuition fees. But for there to be a greater level of maintenance funding from the government, in particular maintenance grants. I think that's the big burden to prospective and current students, is not having enough money to get by at university. So to increase maintenance funding and increase maintenance grants, in particular for lower income individuals, that would be the best route forward.
I mean, I guess Tony Blair might suggest that his experiment has been a success, because before he brought in student loans, there was about half the number of people who were going to university as after, which is curious. What do you put that down to?
I have to say, I don't know necessarily if there's a direct correlation between the two. I know there has been an expansion of the higher education sector, so more universities have opened. Obviously, we had polytechnics opening in the 90s and whatnot. If his goal was to get it to 50%, then it's absolutely been a success. I would say the student finance system as it is, though, you know, as helpful as it is for helping students to access higher education, there are many issues with it, and I wouldn't say it can be completely regarded as a success in that regard.
Could it be regarded as something of a con?
A con is a strong word to use. I think what there definitely has been is a lack of education, and I think it's indicative of the lack of financial education that young people receive in this country, that at 16, 17, 18 years old, we're asking them to make a decision on whether or not they want to take out this, okay, not quite your typical loan, but still a loan in lots of regards, that's going to rack up tens of thousands of pounds of debt. And in many cases, they don't really understand the full terms of it. Certainly our survey suggests that students don't really understand in full the terms of the loan that they've taken out. So, as I say, I don't want to use the word con, but I do think it is problematic, definitely, that we're asking students to make these kind of financial decisions when they've not had the education to support them in doing so.
Well, it sounds very much like you're describing one of those mis-selling scandals.
It's been called that by at least one MP recently, has said that it's got all the features of a mis-selling scandal. From the government's perspective, they could say, well, this information was all out there. And certainly from our perspective at Save the Student, we do our best to try and educate students about the facts of their student loan agreements. But equally, you know, I have heard stories of people saying that they were told by, you know, people in positions of authority, be that teachers or careers advisors, who were given, you know, basically false information, or at the very least misleading information. So it's a very, very messy situation. And because it's not a typical financial product, it's difficult to say whether it was officially missold or not. But I think a lot of people feel that they weren't given adequate information.
Now, the Tories, their announcement is why we're talking about this. They've had to slash the amount of interest that graduates pay, as we've described, by changing the level from the RPI to the CPI. They say they'll cut, not eliminate, interest payments and make up the cost to the government that would cause by reducing the number of university entrants by 100,000 a year. What do you think of that?
I'm not really in favour of any government saying that they want to cut the number of university courses and places available, for a couple of reasons. First of all, they typically tend to look at creative arts degrees or languages or other things like that they don't deem to be high enough value, which is something I completely disagree with. But also, when politicians talk about cutting the number of university places or saying to young people, you don't have to go to university, consider these other routes, we know who they're talking about. They're not talking about their own children. They're not talking about middle class or upper class children. They are talking about people from working class backgrounds that they don't think need to go to university, or they don't think should go to university. So when they're talking about cutting 100,000 places, let's think about where those places are going to go from and who's not going to be able to go to university as a result.
Yes, I think specifically the arts degrees are exactly where they would start wielding the cuts, which is curious, isn't it? Because as a nation, that is the sector in which we punch above our weight.
Well, exactly. Our kind of creative arts sector is one of our most influential exports, you know, in terms of soft power. It's something that we can still hold as a nation when, you know, many would say that we're failing in many other regards. Our creative arts sector is flourishing and is one of our strongest exports. So why we would seek to make it more difficult for people to pursue that, I do not know.
If you had the ear of the minister, what would you tell her?
I would say, number one, make sure you increase that student loan repayment threshold in line with inflation, as was promised, reverse your decision to implement a three-year freeze on it. Students were promised, graduates were promised, when they took out these loans, that that earnings threshold would increase every year. It hasn't done so under the Conservatives, and under Labour, it's looking like it will freeze for 3 years. Make sure you don't do that. Graduates were promised something, and they need to. It needs to be delivered. More widely, I would say definitely look at reducing the interest rates on student loans, but also use this as an opportunity to think more widely about the student finance system. We've had various iterations of student loan repayment plans over the past 20 years, 30 years, and all of them have had various issues of some description. Let's have this opportunity to think about a wider plan for what student finance can look like going forwards.
Very good to talk to you, Tom. Thanks so much for that. Tom Allingham, Communications Director at Save the Student, the UK's largest student money website. So, given all that, do you think that these days, with the amount that it costs, that a university degree is worth it? If we subsidise some degrees, do you think that that would be a good idea? And if so, what kind of subjects do you think that we should be subsidising? And what do you think about the idea of cutting arts degree numbers? It's less likely, say, compared to studying law or medicine, for instance, that you would get a job that would earn you enough money to start paying back the loan. But it's, we've always thought of us in this country as being sort of preeminent in the arts. We certainly punch above our weight, don't we? And are you a student that has gone through or are going through this system at the moment? And what do you think of the student loan system? 0345 6060 973, and specifically about the Conservatives' proposal to reduce the fees paid, the interest on those loans. Is that sufficient to address this problem, or do we need to think more radically than that? 0345 6060 973, LBC.
This is LBC.
At ulisprosperity.com, you buy the car and we pay you up to £600 per month in rental income. For conditions, visit ulisprosperity.com.
Discover the world of Dobble, back in McDonald's Happy Meal. Race through the worlds of music, sports, space and more. How quickly can your little one spot the match? Dobble's bursting with fun. Some fun, some food, it's all inside this Happy Meal. Until the 5th of March 2026, from 11 a.m. Includes one pre-selected book or toy. Dobble range comprises toys only, while stocks last.
All right, resistance up. Let's climb.
Okay, here we go.
Oh, my knee's playing up again.
Have you ever had it looked at?
No, but I've been doing a few stretches.
When my shoulder went, Benenden Health got me expert help. Showed me exactly where I was going wrong.
30 seconds, people.
Press play on your health with physiotherapy and much more. All for less than £16 per person per month. Search Benenden Health. Fee review periodically. T's and C's apply. Qualifying periods apply for some services, including physio. UK only. Visit benenden.co.uk.
Donations to British Heart Foundation fund scientific research that can help save lives. People like Joe, who's pitching his next big business plan. Maria, who's sending out her wedding invitations. And Jack, who's just being a teenager again. Because when you donate, you fund more than just science. You help save lives. British Heart Foundation funds research that aims to cure inherited heart muscle diseases. But our work is not done. Donate now at bhf.org.uk and keep us beating.
This is LBC with Nick Abbott. Call 0345 6060 973. Text 84850. Alexa, send a comment to LBC.
So I went to uni, and if I had thought that I would come out of it with 50, 60, 70,000 pounds worth of debt over my head, I probably wouldn't have bothered. Particularly as the subject I did was not something that is that normally has a direct route into a high-paid job, psychology. And Kemi Badenoch is at least addressing this issue of massive student debt. It seems to be a bit tinkering at the edges. Other political parties, the Greens and the Lib Dems, will want to go further on this. The Labour Party seems reluctant. And it is, of course, the Labour Party that got us into this mess in the first place through Tony Blair's shake-up of the system. He wanted more people to go to uni and have fees applied to their studies, whereas before it was free. As I mentioned in that interview, it was worse than that, kids. They used to give us money to go to uni. So this is the Tories' plan. Under their proposed reforms, graduates on what are called Plan 2 loans, those who studied between 2012 and 2023, would see the amount added to their debt each month cut thanks to a new reduced interest rate. Now, the interest rate that's used at the moment is the Retail Price Index, which is a sort of an old measure of inflation that most people don't use anymore. And it's usually a couple of points higher than CPI, the Consumer Prices Index. But is that really enough to address the issue of a college graduate coming out with £60,000, £70,000 debt that they probably didn't really understand was what was going to happen to them? I mean, you can tell the numbers to an 18-year-old, but it all just seems a bit sort of random to them at that age. I'm sure they don't really appreciate quite the consequences of having that amount of debt hanging over them. The proposal from the Tories is that the first cohort to pay £9,000 a year fees are required to make loan repayments of 9% of their income above the repayment threat. You know what? I'm going to stop there because it just gets very, very complicated when you start talking about thresholds and fees and the amount that you have to earn when you pay it back. So let's think more generally just about the idea of why do we have to pay for it at all? I mean, if places like France and Germany and the happy countries, Norway, Finland, Sweden, Denmark, if they value higher education to the extent that they offer it for free, why can't we? What is the point of being the sixth largest economy in the world? So we keep being told over and over and over again if we don't appear to be able to afford anything. Particularly as most people would agree that education is vital to the future of the country. But we don't act as though it is. We act as though it's a luxury. North Walsham. Hello, Zara.
Hi.
Zara.
Hi, Nick. I was one of the lucky ones. I went to uni and did a fine arts degree with honours, and I graduated in 2005. So I did take out a student loan, but I had three children.
Oh, your phone line, we just dropped there for a moment. So you did take out a student loan, and then what did you say?
I was also given grants.
Grants, yeah, I had that too.
Yeah, because I had three children and I was doing what they classed as an expensive course.
Right.
A
degree in fine art was an expensive course, really?
They classed it as an expensive course because the degree.
This is a very bad line, Zara. Well, we'll try and call you back. We'll try and get Zara back on that. I mean, you know, another thing that we don't seem to value very highly in this country is modern technology. Why is it that I can receive a call from Australia and it comes through clear as a bell, and yet somebody from just down the road, I can't hear a blind word they say. It's just so infuriating. But you know me, I never complain about anything. Neil says, university is not worth it for the arts. My wife and I disagreed on my daughter's course. She's gone, $15,000 a year in debt, and my wife and I have to pay $8,000 a year for accommodation. Blimey. Might as well throw it down the drain, in my opinion, whereas my wife did not know what other options there were, so I lost the battle, and it's my wage that's paying for it, says Neil. Worse still, my daughter doesn't care for the course. Oh, well, that is the worst of all worlds. Oh, Zara's back. Hi, Zara. Yes, sorry about that. Your line kept cutting out, but you were telling us about your experience. You did a BA honours degree in fine arts, and you were one of the lucky ones, like me, that didn't have to pay for it. You got paid by the government, moreover, as did I. And how did you feel that it was worth it? If you had to pay for it, would you have done it?
Well, I did have to pay for it. I think my total loan came to about 9,000.
Right. But that was for everyday living experience. That wasn't for the actual course itself.
That was for the course itself.
Oh, it was? Right.
Yeah. Yeah, but no, money well spent.
Right. So why do you say that?
Well, I think at the time I was working for sort of £5-6 an hour in a normal job.
Yeah.
But it leapt to over 10 once I had that £10-12 an hour, which was a lot going back. So, yeah, it increased my earnings.
But what were you doing to double your earnings with a degree in fine arts?
I was employed to teach, but I was employed to teach adults, so sort of an adult learning type role.
Okay.
And I had Dubai and Australia to teach.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, great experience, wonderful. I mean, it was different for me because I went back as an art student.
Yeah, again, with the phone line. I'm sorry, Zara. Maybe there's something wrong with North Walsham in Norfolk, but you are not coming through loud and clear. But I appreciate the effort. Thanks for that. So what do you make of Kemi Badenoch's plan to address the problem of student loan debts? Because it does seem to be... It does have the stench of a mis-selling scandal. I'm not sure that people that went in had any idea of the consequences of loading themselves with all that debt. A debt that many of them won't be able to pay off probably in their entire lives. And you have to earn £66,000 a year before you can even start to pay off the debt. Most people won't even get close to that in their entire lives. It does seem to be a bit of a scam. Do you think it might be a better idea to go back to what we used to have before Tony Blair started meddling with the system, that fewer of us went to university, and for, I suppose, people regarded it as for the benefit of the nation, that education was free. And because fewer went, it was more affordable for us all. Would you actually be comfortable paying for the education of others through your taxes, even if you did not go to university? 0345 6060 973. So more of your calls on that next. We're going to take a brief moment to get the latest on the news. And we'll be talking about tariffs. Donald Trump says he's going to increase global tariffs to 15% now, or at least that was the last word on the matter from him. Anything could change in the next 5 minutes. We'll get details on that. But first, the headlines with Tim Daly.
Mainstream schools are to get extra funding to support children with special educational needs and disabilities. The measures will be part of a £4 billion package to make them more inclusive, contained in a white paper on education published tomorrow. An armed man's been shot dead after breaching the perimeter of Donald Trump's Mar-a-Lago residence in Florida. He's being named as Austin Tucker Martin from North Carolina. And the Russian-installed governor in part of Ukraine's Zaporizhia region says power's been restored to most areas after a major attack by Kyiv. They say it was concentrated on the area's energy infrastructure. LBC weather, breezy overnight with a mixture of clear spells and showers. Patchy frost in northern areas with a low of around 5 degrees.
This is LBC.
When you're smiling.
Banning Dental Group Clinics, with over 5,000 top-rated Google reviews. Keep on smiling.
Things are really heating up in the country's smallest house.
Dad!
Squealed Mia Mouse.
We could save around £100 by setting the boiler flow temperature to 60 degrees.
And turning radiators down in rooms we don't use.
Interrupted Mo.
Yes, Mo.
Turn them down,
not off, said Mia.
Plus finding and blocking drafts,
said Mo.
Should save enough to increase our allowance.
A little saves a lot. You could save around £100 a year off your energy bills with 3 tips at gov.uk/cleanenergy.
Fly into flip-flop mode. There's still time to get up to £500 off package holidays in EasyJet's Big Orange Sale. Or get flights from £28 one way. EasyJet. Get out there. Selected dates and flights. Limited availability. Holiday sale ends 3rd of March. Min spend and ATL protected. T's and C's apply.
You're really building that business, Josh. That's because you chose to bank with Virgin Money, earning cash back on your supplies, turning expenses into rewards on everything from Sanders to skip hire. He came, he soared, he conquered. Open Virgin Money's M account for business now. UK excludes NI, Channel Islands and Isle of Man. 18 plus. Terms and exclusions apply. Cashback rate of 0.25% backed by the current account switch service. Virgin Money is a trading name of Clydesdale Bank PLC.
This is LBC with Nick Abbott. Call 0345 6060973. Text 84850. Alexa, send a comment to LBC.
Donald Trump has said he is going to impose global tariffs of 15% as he continued to whine about the Supreme Court ruling that struck down his previous import taxes. He said on Friday he would replace the tariffs with a 10% levy on all goods coming into the US, and then on Saturday announced that he changed his mind and now it's going to be 15%. Well, let's talk about this with David Hennick. David is Director of UK Trade Policy Project at the European Centre for International Political Economy think tank. He helped set up the Department for International Trade and joins us on the line now. Hello, David.
Hello.
Well, Trump's tariffs have variously over the past year or so gone from 2.5% to 10%, 25%, 145%, 50%, 18%, and now in the space of one day, 10% and 15%. If you were trying to make trade more difficult, could you think of a better way of doing it?
Well, the good news is that we are still trading, notwithstanding his efforts. The bad news is that the chaos looks likely to continue, particularly if you're having to export to the United States goods, because you never know from one day to the next what the tariff is going to be and whether he's going to change his mind. And I'm afraid the chaos continues, really. I mean, this is all a classic sign. It's 10% one day, 15% the next. And this is under a part of the US law that is only can only be enforced for 150 days. So who knows what will happen after that, if it'll probably be some other parts of the law and with some other rationales. I'm afraid the uncertainty continues.
Yes, I mean, you could be fairly sure that you can't be sure. And that's the kind of thing that businesses hate, isn't it?
I'm afraid so. I'm afraid this looks like the next 3 years for businesses who are exporting goods to the United States is that you're really not going to be able to plan on what the tariff you're likely to face it will be. It could be, frankly, anything from between zero to up to 50% for some steel products. And I think that will continue. There will be investigations into specific products still to come. We think that we may well see tariffs on pharmaceuticals yet. Just any product could be caught by this. Possibly less so if it's food and drink products, as he is starting to worry about inflation with regard to elections coming up in November. So you might be better off if it's food and drink, but frankly, I'm afraid it's still a mess.
Yes, food and drink is hampered, though, by, I'm sure, he would want at least a reciprocal access to our market with the kind of food and drink that our government might not be comfortable putting on British shelves.
Well, funnily enough, the UK Scotch whisky industry has long worked with the American bourbon sector. They both would like zero tariffs, and they actually would be quite happy both ways round. And I think we'd all be quite happy if there weren't tariffs on spirits going either way. But unfortunately, President Trump tends to just like tariffs in general and would say, well, why not just drink US drink? So it makes it really hard for everybody else. To be honest, he doesn't make it easy for US industry either, because if you're making things, you're using imported parts or of various types, you don't know what you're going to be paying for tariffs for those either. So he's not just making it difficult for UK businesses and others around the world, he's making it difficult for businesses in the US constantly, really. It's not much of a consolation to those who are trying to export to the US that he's making it difficult for everybody.
Does any of this make any sense to you? Because Trump insists that tariffs are paid by the country that he has levied those tariffs on, which is not true. Do you think that he genuinely doesn't know how tariffs work, or does he just assume that his cult fans don't know?
He's a long-term supporter of tariffs, and he just thinks that they are some kind of economic cure-all, and that they can achieve everything that he wants to achieve can be achieved by tariffs, almost. And somehow he doesn't realise, and he just thinks that, okay, even if importers do formally pay them, you know, everybody will so much want to do business with the US that they'll end up lowering their prices anyway. I mean, he really does see trade as someone has to win and someone has to lose, and America wins if it imposes tariffs. It's nonsensical, but it's a long-standing view. So I actually think it's a genuine view, even though it's completely wrong-headed.
And it's also a view that seems to be being reinforced by those around him who are in business. Now, they must know that what he's saying isn't true. Do you think that they have stayed silent in the hope that this will just go away, that he'll get obsessed with something else? Or are they just fearful of of any unhinged reaction from him if they raise a complaint?
I think everybody who is dealing with Trump, whether it's other countries or companies within the US or elsewhere, are fearful of what happens if they speak out, that they get a worse deal. Equally, and the other way around, they think that if they quietly kind of cut a deal, make some offer to Trump, they may get a better deal. And in fact, that has happened with some companies, some products. And so everybody is in the same boat here of kind of, they all know that it's nonsense, but they're going through the charade because President Trump doesn't like to be told that it's all nonsense, and they might get a better deal that way. It's no way to run a country. It's no way to run an economic policy, but it's what everybody is having to do. And even when people do have deals, like the UK and Europe, has deals, nobody really expects them to last, or nobody should expect them to last. It's your way of getting through the day or the next week and hope that it sticks for as long as possible. So no, there's a considerable amount of charade here, and it's going to leave a huge mess even in 3 years' time when Trump ceases to be president.
Yeah, it's no way to run a country, but it is a way to run a mafia protection racket, isn't it?
Well, that's words that a number of people have suggested. So, given Trump's business background and some of the people he hung around with, it's probably not entirely surprising.
Now, Keir Starmer is trying to tiptoe lightly around him, and we thought we had a deal for tech prosperity to cover AI, nuclear development, that kind of thing. We had a deal, and then we didn't have a deal because Trump thought, oh, I want something else on top of that, specifically food. And then we had a deal on tariffs at 10%. Now we don't have a deal, and now the rate's 15% today. Who knows what it might be tomorrow? Is there any point in cutting any deal with Donald Trump? Because he doesn't seem to think that anything he signs restricts him in any way.
There is a point in going through this process, trying to do deals, because it might get you a better deal for a week, a month, 6 months. You just have to be entirely cognizant of the fact that it may not hold for any length of time. Now, I don't know how much the UK government always believes what it says with regard to the US. Some people probably do. Many people inside almost certainly don't believe any of this. They know that any deal could be broken at any moment. But it's better to go through the process if you can get lower tariffs, as we have done on cars, for example. We hope we've still got lower tariffs on cars. Then there's an opportunity to export more. It might not last more than a few months, but it's got to be worth trying if you're the UK government. I fear that if you don't even try, then you are going to get the worst outcome. So I think on this occasion, and I'm not always the most generous towards UK government efforts on trade policy, but on this occasion, I do think that they have to go through the motions of dealing with Trump. I don't think you can ignore him. I don't think you can criticise him, and I don't think you can change him. I think you just have to do what you can to offset as much of the chaos as possible.
Yes, but to offset the chaos, might it be a better tactic not to, to prostrate yourself in front of the man and rely on the kindness of this stranger, but to actually fight back? I mean, the Canadian PM, Mark Carney, he was talking about the power that middle-ranking countries have if we just all work together as a team. And wouldn't it make more sense to perhaps work in concert with the European Union and slap similar tariffs on American goods?
Retaliatory tariffs actually are going to have a cost on our consumers, European consumers. Canada has little choice but to fight back because they're under a slightly different situation where their neighbours keep saying, we would like you to be the 51st state of the US. In that scenario, you can't lie down and take that. We are in a different situation. We're being threatened with tariffs. We're not actually at this stage being threatened with something as dramatic as that, and virtually all countries, as say the Canada is an exception, are doing the same as the UK. They are trying to make the most of a bad deal, and you can call it prostrating, or in the case of some countries, business leaders have been turning up with gold bars to the to the White House. So yes. that's even worse. So I fear that isn't a good answer here, but Canada has been forced into it by a different situation to the one we face.
Well, it's only slightly different, though, surely, because, I mean, although we aren't being threatened with invasion, he has declared economic war on us, has he not?
Well, he's declared economic war on himself as well, and on the US, because it's the US consumers who pay the tariffs, and it isn't worth us taking the damage from putting our own tariffs on US products up if that's going to damage our own economies. We're better off almost saying we are not going to be drawn down to his level and this level of chaos. That's not how we want to run our economy. We want to trade with the rest of the world. We'll trade with the US if they come back to sanity, which we're not doing this. We're doing something different. And I think that, you know, That would be my approach. Is I think you're better off displaying your strength by saying we're not lowering ourselves to play in your game, and you're not as important in the world trade system or for us as a country as you think you are. I at the moment, most countries are taking that approach rather than the one of fighting back, because you fight back and he's such a thin-skinned president. He's just going to say, right, I'll put 50% tariffs on you, 1,000,000% tariffs, whatever. And he actually will do it because he's no particular caring for the implications on his own country of doing that.
So what are the implications on our country of a 15% blanket tax on anything that we want to have American consumers buy of ours?
It depends on whether we still get the exemption. So the exemptions we had before on cars, pharmaceuticals, aircraft, they happen to be the three largest components of our goods exports to the US. So if we still have those exemptions, the fact that it goes up to 15% won't make so much difference. Yes, it will be bad for Scotch whiskey and some other food and drink products, and various small products in other sectors will get hit, and that's not good, but the damage will be restricted. It's worse if we start having to pay tariffs, or rather US importers start having to pay tariffs on those major sectors. And we are still expecting something potentially on pharmaceuticals, and he may not do anything on aircraft parts, because that will go straight to onto the costs for US consumers. But so we may get away with the worst of this just because of the nature of those exemptions. But those exemptions are exactly what those US businesses are lobbying for, because Boeing, for example, and US airlines, they need exemptions on parts coming from the UK and Europe, so they'll probably get them.
Yeah, those are major industries, and that's the effect on our economy. But for smaller companies who have targeted the American consumer, and they perhaps, you know, spent years, if not decades, honing their products and, you know, aligning their production lines for the American market, now to get slapped with an extra 15%, which they weren't expecting, I mean, that could be terminal for quite a lot of businesses, surely.
Yes, and small businesses are undoubtedly the worst hit by what is happening with the US, and there's not a huge amount that they can do about it. One hopes that they have other markets which are more receptive to their products, so they're trying to find them, but inevitably if the trade rules break down in the world's largest consumer market, the US, then that is going to affect a number of businesses, and one has to feel a little bit sorry for anybody who is in that situation, and hope that they can find other ways, other markets, in which to keep their businesses going. There's not very much one can say optimistically on that one.
it's a pretty bad time to have made it more difficult to trade with our biggest trading partner, isn't it?
Well, we clearly, UK businesses are in a more difficult situation to those of most of our neighbours who at least can trade with each other more easily. That's how I would put that. We do, our businesses do face barriers that are not faced by businesses in France or Germany. That is a problem for UK business.
Good to talk to you, David. Thanks so much for that. David Hennig, Director of UK Trade Policy Project at the European Centre for International Political Economy think tank. He helped set up the Department for International Trade. So we're going to take a short break now, and then back to your thoughts about the cost of higher education. The Conservative Party is addressing that, particularly the interest rates that are paid by students on the amount that they've had to borrow. It does seem counterintuitive that a government that is, you know, it's talks all the time about levelling up and is interested in the future of the country, and wants us to be as educated a country as possible, seem to be making it as difficult as they can for people to go ahead and, you know, achieve the maximum potential that they can at university because of the cost of doing so. Why does it cost £9,000 a year here, with all of the interest on top of that, which is compound, of course, and it just gets worse and worse and worse with each passing year? And countries like Germany and Norway and Sweden, and they offer their higher education at the same price that we used to. Nothing. Free. Do you think the university education is worth it anymore? And do you welcome this idea that Kemi Badenoch has put forward of reducing the interest rate on that debt? Or should we be thinking a bit bigger than that? 0345 6060 973. LBC.
Nick Ferrari at breakfast on LBC.
A prime minister in office, but not in power.
There's only now a matter of when he goes, not if he goes.
A government that's a bit of a joke and falling flat.
Chancellor, I've got something for you. Happy pancake day.
Thank you very much, Prime Minister.
But if the government loses a crucial by-election in Gorton and Denton next week,
what we all need to do now is drive the pace of change. That means greater unity.
Is it time to handy over to Andy?
Nick Ferrari at breakfast. Back tomorrow morning from 7. Listen on our free Global Player app or the LBC app.
JP Morgan Personal Investing gives you the clarity to make more informed decisions on your investments, which is great because right now something else just became crystal clear. Your kid just outgrew the kids menu. Now he's ordering a truffle gnocchi. You consider making a don't gnocchi it till you try it joke, but now's not the time. Now's the time to grow his world, one bite at a time. Search JP Morgan Personal Investing. Invest with clarity. Capital at risk.
On a windswept walk in Carmarthen, while someone tries to use your card details to hire a speedboat in Cannes, this is the moment that you relax, knowing that Barclays Advanced Tech has helped to spot the fraud in under a second, and their expert team are on hand to close it down. So you can get back to being windswept. Oh, just one of the ways we're protecting our customers 24/7. Search Barclays Fraud Protection. Barclays, make money work for you.
Okay, done. Move that and... Oh, new ways to invest.
Okay.
Foolproof guaranteed returns. Invest today.
All right, I think I will.
Way before you seal the deal, check if it's real and if a company's authorised by the FCA.
Oh, thanks.
Search FCA Firm Checker.
Sunlight's guaranteed over 50 plan gave confidence to Jane and Chris. With their insurance sorted, they're becoming naturists. Cutting loose in their birthday suits, feeling elegant and free. But when they answered the door, the postman saw more than he expected to see. Sunlight, a little confidence goes a long way. No medical questions and a cash payout. Search Sunlight cover today.
Premiums paid could exceed the payment. Full cover after 1 year. Ages 49 to 85.
Nick Abbott on LBC. Call 0345 6060 973.
So we're talking about the problems that students face, the enormous amount of debt that they rack up when they go through university. And to some extent, you can blame Tony Blair for this, because it was his idea that 50% of the population should go to university. And in order to pay for that, then the students themselves had to pay a fee to go to uni, where previously it was free. And if you go back to the 1960s, something like 3% of the people in the country went to university. It ticked up to about 15%, something like that, by the time that Tony Blair had his big idea. And as I said, he wanted 50%, half of us, to go to university. I mean, do you think that that's actually worthwhile for half of us to do that? And do you think that a degree is worth it these days, considering the amount of debt that you have to saddle in doing so? Tooting. Hello, Gary.
Hello, Nick. I'd like to offer a perspective and then a potential solution to at least part of the problem that you have so clearly identified. I'm probably about contemporaneous with yourself. I went to university. I didn't pay any fees. I got a grant. I even got housing benefit and the dole during the vacation. But when I was sitting there in the law faculty listening to lectures, sitting next to me was kind of the son of a barrister who was also paying no fees. And sitting on the other side was the daughter of a consultant who was also paying no fees. So who was paying those fees? The answer is it was the cleaners that were sorting out the lecture theatre before we went in. It was the bus drivers who were taking us into college.
Yeah.
And when the fees came in, I thought, well, this is a good idea, because there are three main beneficiaries of higher education. It's much broader than that. But the three main beneficiaries are the student, the state, and the employer. And I think the student, initially paying £1,000, later £3,000, and then getting completely out of hand and bonkers, £9,000. But I think the £1,000 wasn't a bad idea. Even the £3,000 wasn't so bad an idea. But then the state was rightly paying, because the state supports that. But the employer doesn't, and they still don't today. And my suggestion to break the logjam of student debt would be to go to employers or instill pass a law that says for your first graduate, the graduate's first job, the employer pays £3,000 or £5,000, whatever it might be. For the second job that graduate does, because they're all tracked, because, you know, their student loans track them through national insurance number and stuff like that. Second job, it's a sliding scale, so £2,000, third job it's £1,000. And let's take a bite out of this vast network of corporate welfare that we're running in this country, seemingly without anybody challenging it, until a Jim Ratcliffe says, I want £500 million to keep a steelworks open or whatever it is.
Yeah.
So let's go to Accenture, let's go to KPMG and say, look, you're creaming off the graduates, you're creaming off what higher education provides, and you're paying nothing for it. So actually, you start paying a little bit. Now, obviously, when it comes to the NHS and things like that, there'd be waivers, but that would start to get some money back into the system. It would start to make the university experience better, not just for the students, but for the staff, and allow us to maintain what has been a glory of this country's work over hundreds of years, and not see it slide down the drain like so much else that we've got. So let's take a bite out of that. And I'll just say one more thing, if I may, Nick.
Yeah.
Is my son, my elder son, is currently at the University of Copenhagen doing his master's. Because he has a Swedish passport, he pays zero in fees.
Yeah.
And you just look at it and you think, how have we got to this place, you know, like, you know, in the Talking Heads song, my God, how did we get here?
Yes. Well, one of the ways in which we got here is that we left the European Union, and now students can't go and avail themselves of free education in Europe. So there's that. But it's an interesting proposal. I think that it might make some employers less inclined to employ or give jobs to to graduates, though.
Really?
Yes, I do think so, because there is a thing that we haven't talked about yet, which is going to be very relevant, and more so with each passing day, and that's artificial intelligence. All the companies that you mentioned, and the sectors in which they work, they're all drawing back on the number of graduates they employ now, because they don't think that there's going to be any work for them, or that it'd be more profitable to have a robot do it in some point in the future. So if you make it more expensive to employ a graduate for, you know, these city companies that you talked about, I think that's going to precipitate that that takeover of robots with the jobs that people used to go through university to snatch.
Well, it might be the case, Nick, and if that is the case, we've got bigger problems than paying £3,000 to a graduate.
I think
but
so.
What I would say is, in politics, they tell you to never answer a hypothetical question, and it is still hypothetical as whether the AI revolution will be as revolutionary as it's said to be. Mm. Now, it certainly will change the workplace, but as any fool knows, as they say in private eye, a lot of this stuff, especially in the city, in it, the higher echelons, and I'm mainly talking about those kind of graduate jobs where there is real fat on the bone that we can take off these companies. I mean, even like Tesco, what do they make? £3 billion a year profit or something? They can afford to pay it as well.
being able to afford to pay it is not necessarily related to a willingness to actually pay it, though. But good talking to you, Gary. I'm going to have to leave it there because I've just run out of time in this hour. There will no doubt be opportunities to talk about this idea from the Tories to slash the amount of interest that graduates pay. The Greens want to eliminate the fees altogether, and the Lib Dems want to significantly reduce it. The paper is coming out tomorrow, in fact. So we'll be discussing it, no doubt, on LBC. Going to break for the news, and then it's a related story. Ministers have set a target to halve the disadvantage gap to improve the education system in England. Do you feel that your education put you at a disadvantage? And if so, in what way? And what needs to change to bridge the so-called disadvantage gap?
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at midnight. The government's preparing to publish a new white paper on the future of education, saying it will include a £4 billion package to make the system more inclusive. It's due to be set out later on today and proposes extra funding for mainstream schools to help them work with children with special educational needs and disabilities. Harry Quilter Pinner from the Institute for Public Policy Research think tank has been talking to LBC.
What we're expecting and hoping to see is that more of that resource will go into schools earlier so they can support kids before problems become acute, whilst they're still in mainstream schooling, to prevent them having to grapple with the complexity and the challenges of trying to get an education, health and care plan.
Reform UK is proposing to give listed status to all churches to prevent them being converted into alternative places of worship. Its Home Affairs spokesman Zia Youssef is due to announce the measure during a speech in Dover later on today. He'll also propose a visa freeze for nations which refuse to accept deportees with no legal right to be in the UK. The FBI has taken over the investigation into the death of a man who was shot at President Trump's Mar-a-Lago resort. 21-year-old Austin Tucker Martin from North Carolina was killed after being seen with a shotgun and fuel can. LBC's U.S. correspondent is Ira Spitzer.
We've heard from the White House press secretary, Karoline Leavitt, calling this a crazy person. And we also heard from Scott Bessent, the Treasury secretary, who said, we don't know whether this person was a mastermind, unhinged, or what. At least according to Trump administration officials, they don't know yet what the state of mind of this person was.
A fire at a property near a Catholic church in Northamptonshire is being treated as a case of arson with intent to endanger life. It happened in the town of Rushton just before 4 o'clock on Sunday morning. Police in County Londonderry are investigating what's being called a viable device. It was found in the village of Upperlands on Saturday evening. And a Ukrainian attack on the Russian city of Belgorod and its surrounding area is being described as massive by the region's governor. They say people are now experiencing power cuts and interruptions to water and heat supplies. LBC weather, breezy overnight with a mixture of clear spells and showers. Patchy frost for northern districts. We'll see a low of around 5 degrees. From Global's newsroom, for LBC, I'm Tim Daly.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Nick Abbott.
Ministers will set a target to halve the disadvantage gap by the time children born under this government finish secondary school as part of their plan to improve the education system in England. To tackle the achievement gap between pupils from poorer backgrounds and their more affluent peers, the government will reform how schools get targeted disadvantage funding. The white paper published on Monday will also set out two new programmes to tackle the performance of disadvantaged pupils locally in the northeast and on the coasts. Let's talk about this with Dr. Lisa McKenzie. Dr. McKenzie is a working class academic and senior inequality lecturer at the University of Bedfordshire and joins us on the line now. Good evening, Doctor.
Good evening. How are you?
Very well, thanks. So what do you make of what you've heard from these proposals?
Well, do you want to be honest? I hear this most years. I've been working in education since 2008. And every single year since 2008, when I was starting as a lecturer at the university, I've heard every single year that some government or there's some policy that's coming out that's looking at inequality throughout the country and realising that education is a big part of that. And over the years, there's been many policies that are sent to tackle this inequality. And yet, over the last 25 years, inequality amongst the regions especially and class inequality is actually widening, so much so that 15 years ago they set up the Social Mobility Commission, and that's been going now, I think, releasing reports for at least 10 years now, and still there's massive regional and class inequality. So I'm cautiously pleased that this government is sort of acknowledging that there's massive inequalities, that social mobility is stagnant. I'm quietly pleased that they're recognising that, but I'm not sure that what they're about to propose is going to be able to even tackle any of this.
Well, what's the basis then of these regional and class inequalities? I mean, why would it be that people on the coast do worse than people away from the sea?
Yeah, it's not really anything to do with, the sea. It's like, where I live, I'm in Nottinghamshire, which is obviously part of the Red Wall. It's very similar to the coastal areas that, over many years, over a couple of generations has really declined. Employment has declined, the quality of employment has declined, the regions have become much poorer, resources that have gone into, all services that people need has been restricted in these areas. And particularly in the Blair years and actually the Cameron years as well, inner cities started to get a lot more funding, and inner city schools especially started to get a lot more funding. In the 80s and 90s, the schools in London were awful and the results that were coming out of London was terrible. But there's been a massive change in infrastructure in the London schools and also in resources. And you can really see that now with the results. The London schools are doing really well, but the regional areas are actually really falling behind. And it's a multitude of reasons. It's not just one. It's deindustrialisation. It's the loss of the decent jobs that was around the country. It's the general sort of decline of these areas. hopelessness has moved in, poor mental health, even drug use is high in these sort of areas, in the coastal areas and the red wall areas. And obviously, you know, that affects social mobility. It affects how people see themselves. It affects how people see their future. And this has been, you know, this has been happening for 40 years. So that's why I said, you know, at the beginning of the interview that I've watched this for at least 20 years, different governments and different organisations sort of bringing attention to this. But whether or not they've got to the crux of the problem, which is a multitude of things rather than just one. So do I welcome a policy that says, look, we're going to look at the schools, we're going to look at our education system, we recognise that there's inequalities, and we're going to start to put resources and make changes? I absolutely do welcome that. But if you're putting resources into the education system in areas that have been run down, that there are no jobs, that are filled with, you know, poor quality housing, there's a lot of poverty, and there's, you know, the only thing you can do is get out, you know, that doesn't really solve the problem, does it? It just moves it somewhere else.
Yes, but it seems curious that if you are a child in a school and, you know, presumably you have the same, more or less the same advantages as somebody, you know, in a school in the south, if you're in the northeast or at the coasts, and you see around you that, you know, it's life is difficult outside school, then wouldn't that propel you to do better in school in order to avoid that fate when you leave?
Well, no, because people don't, you know, what there's a saying, isn't there? You can only be what you can see. And if you can't see, you know, I mean, if we look at just some of the sectors, you know, sort of politics, media, the creative arts, you know, the creative industries, if you look at those industries, they are absolutely overwhelmingly middle class and working class people from all over the country are not represented in those areas. It's very difficult for working class people to get into many of these sorts of sectors. You know, I sort of use this phrase, which is, who is entitled to interesting work? You know, and it's never the working class. So for me, a lot of industries, creative industries, politics, media, are actually closed pretty much to working class people. And then at the same time, is in a lot of the areas like the coastal areas and the red wall areas, you know, these also suffer from multiple disadvantages, such as lack of employment. So, you know, the idea that you'd sort of be at school now as a 15-year-old and you'd say, you know, look at it, it's really terrible here, it's quite depressing, and somehow you'd know that there were these other things that you could do. I mean, well, how are you going to know that? Because, you know, the universities don't go into these areas. I live in Ashfield, actually, which is an old mining community. The schools here, I doubt that the local universities go into the schools and, you know, to talk to the young people about that. You know, I'm connected to some of the alternative provision schools in this area. Things are very difficult. And, you know, I can tell you now from my from experience of living in these sort of communities, is that young people, that, you know, they are full of hope. But it doesn't take long for that hopelessness to sort of come in when, you know, they can't see a future. You know, they don't know where they're going to go. You know, here in Nottinghamshire, we've got BTEC courses in the colleges that teach you how to work in a warehouse. You know, that's not really filling people with hope, is it?
No. So how would more money for schools actually address that issue? What would the schools do with that money to effect a change?
Well, that's I suppose what my question is. I'm glad that more money is going to go into schools and it's going to start to address perhaps the educational inequalities. You know, it might stop young people, you know, leaving school with very basic English and maths. You know, they might have a better education, they might have better GCSEs, but how is that, and I think that's the key question, how is that going to change when the part of the country that you live in has been deprived over many, many years, over, you know, generations, actually. You know, it's not. And unfortunately, that would be the question that I would throw back now at Bridget Phillipson is, in the Northeast, in the East Midlands, and the coastal areas, you know, we can raise kids' aspirations. We can do that, and we can put money into schools, and we can raise their GCSEs. But what are we going to do about the jobs? You know, what are we going to do about the areas that are economically deprived? You can't just do one thing. So, yes, it's welcome, but I don't know what else it's going to do, you know, unless we're encouraging all young people who live in deprived areas to leave. And then obviously those communities then become even more deprived if the talent leaves. So, you know, I think we need a bit of honesty, actually, about this policy.
Do we also need to accept that it's not all the school's fault, that perhaps if a child is under attaining, then it might be something to do with the parents, it might be something to do with the food that they're eating, it might be something to do with genetics?
Well, I don't think it's to do with genetics, unless we're moving down the route of the eugenics movement, where some people, you know, where people are naturally cleverer than others.
If two tall parents have a child, then that child's likely to be tall. If two blonde parents have a child, it's likely to be blonde. If two intelligent parents have a child, is it not likely that that child will be more intelligent than average?
Well, I don't know, but it depends again how are we sort of defining intelligence.
In this instance, the ability to pass your GCSEs, I guess.
Yeah, and that's not everything, is it? Ability to pass GCSEs. Because, you know, I've worked at some of the most elite universities in the country, you know, and I've taught students, in order to pass their GCSEs, they went to private schools and also had extra private tuition as well. That doesn't tell you anything. Being able to pass GCSEs doesn't really tell you anything about intelligence. It only tells you about the education system that you've been in and your ability to pass those GCSEs in accordance with that system. It doesn't actually tell you anything about intelligence. I've taught students at some of the very elite universities that, you know, it took them quite a few years to get through their A-levels, but because there was always the resources there to back them up, and there was lots and lots of extra tuition, they actually passed them and got through. It doesn't really say anything about, you know, them. It says a lot about the system. So am I going to start blaming working class parents who, you know, are struggling day to day, struggling to put food on the table, struggling to pay rent? You know, am I going to start blaming them because perhaps they don't have the time or the inclination or even the skill to go to help someone with their children with their homework? I'm not going to blame them, no.
Well, inclination yeah. is a rather damning word, though. If parents don't have the inclination to help their kids...
Well, no, because you could be exhausted. You know, at the end of the day, you could be absolutely exhausted. You could absolutely be filled with anxiety over your own life. You know, I've been in that situation.
A lot of people who aren't working class have been in that situation. I mean, you know, people in the city work 16-hour days, and I'm sure they're exhausted when they come home, and they're fearful of their position.
They can pay for a private tutor, and they can pay for private education. So what they can do is they can fill their gaps where they're not adequate as a parent. So I'm not saying that working class parents are all perfect. I'm saying that there are problems, but with other groups, with the middle class, they can fill their inadequacies with private education and private tutoring.
You'd have to be a pretty well off person in the middle class to be able to do that. I think we're talking about rich people, which is not what I would call middle class.
Well, I don't know, because, you know, I have met people who, you know, are not overly you know, they've got, you know, you've got two professional parents. And like you said, if you've got two parents, say both are barristers, statistically, it's significant that their child may become a barrister or someone else in the professions. Mm. Is that because their parents, you know, have passed on their sort of superior genetics? Or is it because, you know, knowing what a barrister is, having the connections to get you into, you know, sort of...
Yeah, so I understand what you're saying.
Yeah.
But do you completely dismiss the part of that equation that is the barrister parents or somebody of that sort of educational attainment would pass on perhaps the genes that would allow their offspring to attain great things?
Well, no, I don't think that's what happens, because if we say that means that the outcome is the proof of that, and if the outcome and the proof is that of that, then we're all exactly where we need to be, you know.
But it's a factor, it surely must be a factor.
No, the factor is that two parents who are barristers have got lots of economic capital, lots of cultural capital, and lots of social capital as well.
Right.
So therefore, have got lots of resources.
Yes, I accept all of that, but do you not accept at all that a child's ability is dependent in some way on the ability of their parents?
No, I don't accept that, because if that was true, we wouldn't have Richard Hoggart, we wouldn't have had D.H. Lawrence.
Well, yes, but those are specific examples, and I'm talking about averages.
Well, you know, would you have me? Would I exist?
No,
you know,
of course not. My dad
was a coal miner. Yes, my mum worked in a factory. By that logic, that, you know, there's no way that I could have done a PhD.
No, well, I'm not saying that. Of course I'm not. I'm just saying on average. I mean, that is surely what we're talking about, averages.
Well, I don't think that's what we are talking about. I think we are talking about outcomes. Well,
yeah, I'm just saying that. Is it possible that we expect too much of some people, and that giving them, you know, more concentrated education at school is actually not helping them, because they're not going to take the best of what is being offered to them, because they don't have the sort of intellectual ability or
are you just saying that about working class kids, or are you also saying that about middle class kids?
No, of course I'm saying that.
So are you saying
child,
if middle class kids?
No, I'm just.
Are you saying that if middle class?
Well, let me tell
kids,
you what I'm saying. I'm saying that it seems logical that if a parent can pass on their genetics as far as height, weight, bone structure, looks, hair colour, and so on, then is it not possible that they also pass on, at least to some degree, their ability to achieve as far as educational attainment goes?
Well, what you're talking now, are you talking IQ? Is this what you are you talking about? IQ tests?
Well, no,
are you saying that two people who've got a high IQ?
No, it's, well, yes, okay, if you want to put it like that, two people who've got a high IQ, if they have offspring, then that offspring is quite likely, it wouldn't be a surprise if they had also the ability to pass IQ tests. But that's not the it of, you know,
no,
your attainment in life, but it's an indicator.
Well, it could be an indicator. I mean, I've never seen any evidence actually that IQ tests are actually intelligence is passed on. I've seen lots and lots of evidence that IQ tests have been used quite badly in order to excuse inequalities.
Yes, yes. I would agree with that, but I didn't bring up IQ tests. I'm just talking about abilities in general.
Because I'm saying that in a household that has got lots of books, that's got lots of networks to professions, that's got lots of resources to help you along.
Mm.
And if you need, you know, and if you need to work in London for a year for free,
yes,
that,
yes,
you know, those resources, you know, I accept that all of that means that, you know, you that the class system is reproduced,
mm-hmm.
But I think it's reproduced because of those social factors.
Yes.
That's what I would say.
I would agree with you, but my point is that I would suggest that it's not the only thing that is a factor. But I'm afraid,
I'd say it's the most important thing.
Well, there's no evidence for that, but perhaps. I'm going to have to leave it there, Doctor, but thanks so much for your time. That's Dr. Lisa McKenzie, working class academic, senior inequality lecturer at the University of Bedfordshire. Yeah, let's have a heated debate. So the Education Secretary, Bridget Phillipson, says that children that have studied under a one-size-fits-all system are not being best served by that system. So in a one-size-fits-all system, are the most able being held back by the least able, or are the least able being pulled up by being taught with the most able? And, by the way, the government says they have a new target for attendance to recover 20 million lost school days in the next 3 years. So why has attendance got so low as to need a government target to get it back up again? 0345 6060 973 LBC.
This is LBC.
Older cars can be a bit noisy and a bit cold and a bit clunky over the potholes. At Harwoods, we'll help you choose an altogether more civilised car. Let us show you the difference at Harwoods, Audi, Southampton and Portsmouth. With our wide range of new cars in stock, you can drive a civilised new 26 plate this spring. Details at harwoods.co.uk. Harwoods, family owned since 1931.
As a business owner in the South East, you're full of potential, and so is your business. But to grow, to get somewhere new, you've got to try something new. So look around you. There's no better time than now to invest in a bright young T-level student. They'll inject fresh ideas and perspectives into your business, no matter its size. So go on, try something new.
It all starts with skills. Search Skills for Life.
Nick Abbott on LBC. Call 0345 6060 973.
So the government is claiming that it is intent on halving the disadvantage gap by the time that children born under this government finish secondary school. This is part of their plan to improve the education system in England. To tackle the achievement gap between pupils from poorer backgrounds and their more affluent peers, the government is going to reform how schools get targeted disadvantage funding. Do you think that just throwing money at it is going to actually solve the problem? Do you think that your background informs what success you will have in life? And if so, what is the school's role in that? 0345 6060 973. Richmond, Aisling.
Hi, Nick. How are you?
Good, thanks.
Good. So I think listening to some of the presenters talking about this today, a lot of the kind of feedback so far sounded quite negative, but it actually sounds so far like it could be really positive, the changes that they want to bring in. And obviously we don't know exactly yet what they are, but from what's been leaked, it sounds like they're coming at it from a much more nuanced angle. But the way that people were speaking about it today, they were nearly scaring some parents and people into what it sounds like it might be. But
What were they saying? Give us an idea.
Well, so they were saying that the whole SEND system was going to be changed and that people were going to have to be reassessed going into secondary school.
Yeah.
But what it seems like Bridget Phillipson wants to do, and with everyone in the cabinet at the moment, I think she's actually really, really good. She seems really genuine. She seems really interested in her brief, and she seems to really know her brief. And everything that she's brought in so far and everything that she's spoken about so far sounds really in line with research and with the changes that are happening right in a lot of other places.
Now, you mentioned SEND. Let me just explain to people who don't know what that is, because there's a lot of acronyms in all of this. SEND,
yeah.
Special Education Needs and Disabilities Children, according to this proposal, will have their EHCP, that is their Education, Health and Care Plan, reassessed from 2029, which will give them an ISP, an individual support plan. Do you know what that means.
Yeah. So I think, and I think that's what's scaring people, because people think that the plan that they've had to work so hard to get in place for their children is now going to be taken away. But that's not what she's saying. I imagine that a lot of the changes that are due to come in won't actually affect current recipients. But what Bridget Phillipson's saying is that they're going to take it more of an approach now of taking a needs-based approach as opposed to a diagnosis-based approach.
Right.
And when you take a diagnosis-based approach, I think that's where a lot of the problem comes from, because parents have to go through so much to get this in place for their children. It actually contributes to the sense of learned helplessness. By the time they're finished the process, they're almost, their condition is almost exacerbated because they've had to prove the struggle so much that... So taking a needs-based approach will meet the needs rather than needing a diagnosis.
Right.
And that's what's happening in a lot of other countries too. It's quite unique the way they do it in this country, by having to go through local council. To,
yes.
It's
I think it's based, like, the disadvantaged money, is, as much as it's available, is based at the moment, I think, on whether a family takes up the option of free school meals. Is that
yeah,
right?
Yeah, exactly. Now they're, and that's
going to,
big issue.
Well, they're going to remove that and now see whether a child is eligible as to how low the family income is, how long it has been that low, and take into account where the child lives. That seems very complicated. Do you think that it could be easier than that?
It is, but it's complicated in every country. You see, in Ireland they have a system called DESH. But indicators of disadvantage are always difficult to measure, and this is across the board. And I think one of the, and again, you'll know this, but with a lot of the countries that have a more equal education system, they are the ones that don't have this divided education system of private school and state school, and everyone kind of goes to the same school. So it's not as much of an issue having to assess a disadvantage because everyone goes to their local school.
Right. But isn't that what the education secretary is saying is not working, this one-size-fits-all system?
I think what she means is a one-size-fits-all system from the perspective of in terms of individual education plans, because one-size-fits-all doesn't work, because you can't put a plan in place based on a diagnosis when people present in all kinds of different ways.
Yeah, right.
I think one diagnosis can
cover a whole rainbow of different conditions.
Exactly. Yeah. But I think what I would just like to say is that I think from what Bridget Phillipson's saying, it sounds like she's really coming from the right place. So I hope that parents don't feel scared, especially until they know what this is actually going to look like, because it sounds like it's just in line with the research. They brought in something in Ireland in 2017 called school profiling, which, again, they tried to come from a needs-based approach rather than a diagnosis-based. Disadvantage is always hard because the indicators are what you do. I mean, you know, school meals is always kind of the one that they kind of resorted to, and in Ireland it's a medical card, and there's different, but indicators is an issue. But I suppose that's where, again, if you're coming from a needs-based approach, you're not going to be relying as much on those metrics.
Right. I think I'm going to have to leave it there, but thanks for that. Let's see if I can squeeze one more in before the news. Crystal Palace, hello, Louis.
Hi.
Louis.
Nick, pleasure speaking to you. I'll get straight to it. There's a lack of qualified, targeted send TAs being provided into schools. That's going to be a huge, huge, massive cost. We don't need, there to be no mention of the difference between neurodiversity and typical illnesses. Before we can even get to the diagnosis of someone that is autistic, right, there's three levels that we've got to assess them on. Do you see what I mean? So a teacher is not even driven even towards that to deliver that in the class. I've been a supply teacher and a teaching assistant and a sports coach for many years. Within that split hour, just 1 hour, I have to assess every single individual and try and make the most of that 1 hour. Based on what I can observe. Now, if we're placing that approach on, we're placing that pressure on teachers, on councils, local authorities. We've seen it doesn't work. We've seen it hasn't been working. We've got parents. There's a parent, there's definitely a parent that's listening right now that is probably going through a court case or some tribunal to get more assistance for their child within the school.
Well, as far I'm going to have to leave it there, Louis, because I'm past the news, but as far as I'm aware, that is one of the things that the government is trying to address, and we'll know more when the white paper comes out and we can hear what is in it. Later today, in fact, due out later today. But thanks for that, Louis. Still to come, there's a change in the air. The weather is certainly on the up. We'll get a weather forecast, and we'll also check in with our US correspondent. But now, news update with Tim Daly.
The government is preparing to publish a new white paper on the future of education, saying it will include a £4 billion package to make the system more inclusive. It's due to be set out later on today, proposing extra funding for mainstream schools to help them work with children with special educational needs and disabilities. Reform UK is proposing to give listed status to all churches to prevent them being converted into alternative places of worship. Its Home Affairs spokesman is due to announce the measure during a speech in Dover later on. And the FBI has taken over the investigation into the death of a man who was shot at President Trump's Mar-a-Lago resort. 21-year-old Austin Tucker Martin from North Carolina was killed after being seen with a shotgun and a fuel can. LBC weather, breezy overnight with a mixture of clear spells and showers, mild with a patchy frost in northern areas, lows of around 5 degrees.
LBC.
Get extra support with Immunace multivitamins, with vitamin D, zinc and selenium, which contribute to the normal function of the immune system. Immunace from Vitabiotics, the UK's number one vitamin company. Verification at Vitabiotics.com. From Boots, Pharmacies and Vitabiotics.com. It's time to scale up that fishmonger business, Anne. With free day-to-day online banking from Virgin Money, you'll be a big fish in no time. Now that's a real catch of the day. Open Virgin Money's M account for business now. UK excludes NI, Channel Islands and Isle of Man. 18 plus fees apply for chats and international payments. Terms and exclusions apply. Backed by the current account switch service. Virgin Money is a trading name of Clydesdale Bank PLC.
A Southern Train is a place where family moments become more peaceful. Where you can spread out and a game of I Spy gets a scenic upgrade with snacks, stories and the occasional sheep for a bonus point. Less stress, more yes with kids tickets for £2 at southernrailway.com. Terms apply.
A safe trip begins with TRIP. Take a road trip with your family, get there safely. Do your trip checks. T, top up on island fuel. Rest every 2 hours too. I inspect tire pressure and tread. P, prepare for the weather ahead. A safe trip begins with TRIP. A safe trip begins with
TRIP. Think, do the 4 trip checks before every long journey. National Highways.
Nick Abbott on LBC. Call 0345 6060973.
Well, there is a change in the air. Spring has almost sprung. You can feel it coming. Let's talk about this with John Ketley, the weather forecaster and broadcaster, who joins us on the line now. Hello, John.
Hello, good evening to you, Nick.
Well, it's significantly different from the last time that we spoke, when we were talking about the potential for snow and ice and freezing cold. And it's happening. It's actually happening. Spring is on the way.
Yeah, it feels like it, doesn't it? I have to say, there's been a bit of a feeling of spring. We've seen temperatures up around 15 degrees in some places over the weekend. Not in the north, of course, yet it's still pretty chilly over Scotland. But down south, yeah, we've seen these higher temperatures driven on by these southwesterly or westerly breezes coming in from the Atlantic now. So whereas for much of the last couple of months, it seems that we've been having the jet stream to the south, it's been bringing much colder weather across much of the UK, but now we've changed things around. The colder weather is in retreat, and we've got, for a few days at least, we've got these higher temperatures. So it could well be that, especially on Tuesday into Wednesday, that we do see one or two spots getting up to 18 degrees, which is, well, very, very, very pleasing, I think.
Yes. Now, you've mentioned this, the jet stream before. Does it act sort of like a wall? And when it's south of us, it sort of pushes the warmth of the European air away and pulls in the air from the North Pole, and then vice versa. If it's to the north of us, then we experience what we're about to.
Yeah, that tends to be the result of things. If the jet stream is further north, where it would be normally, in a normal winter, the jet stream is generally bringing the heaviest rainfall, the strongest winds, to northwestern parts of the UK. That's its standard position, but of course there's nothing standard about the British weather, as we all know. So it's been in turmoil for the last 8 weeks. It's now going back into the north again, so we are going to see these higher temperatures covering most of the country. So quite a change to come. And just looking back in history, and I do like to look back in previous years and to see how the records have been. And back in 1998, we did see temperatures pretty close to 20 degrees in parts of Somerset, I think it was, where we had the highest temperatures there. Hmm. And that was in half term. But it was a little bit earlier that year, 1998. I think half term was round about the 15th, 16th of the month. But in 2019, we again saw temperatures of 21 degrees on the 26th of February. So it's not unusual to get these higher temperatures just for a few days in the second half of February in particular. So although it seems like a bit of a bolt from the blue, something of a surprise and a feeling of spring, it's the sort of thing that can happen from year to year, although it's not guaranteed by any means, as indeed many parts of the, many things about the British weather, is nothing guaranteed about it at all. There's no likelihood that we're going to see this milder weather continue by any means. So, just around the corner, there's probably another little cold snap to come.
I remember, was it 2020, just before COVID struck and we were locked in? I remember going to Kew Gardens in February, and it was the warmest day in February I could ever remember. And Kew Gardens was the busiest I've ever seen it. It was absolutely rammed. Everybody had read the weather forecast and all went out as, with one mind to go to Kew. And then we had that fantastic spring. I know it's hoping too much that the one might lead to the other, but can patterns repeat like that?
It's a starting point when you're doing a forecast in the longer term. Yes, it's a starting point. It is nice to compare like with like, or previous years where we've seen similar conditions. You're absolutely right about 2020. It was a glorious spring. And the thing about it was, of course, there were no aeroplanes flying around, were there? And you weren't really supposed to go out too much, but it was very nice in the garden while it lasted. But I think this year, if we're back to normality, as it were, we've got to think that these milder conditions are going to be more the norm than they have been in recent weeks, at least. Although, just a word of warning, bit of a precursor, I think come Thursday, Friday, we probably will see temperatures plummet again. Oh. So from, say, 18 degrees on Wednesday, you could be down at about 8 to 10 degrees come the end of the week on Friday, a little band of rain going through, and then things start to recover again at the end of the weekend. But we will see frost come back, and we're not going to see frost, or we haven't seen much frost in the past week or so. So the frosts are coming back come Friday night into Saturday morning, and then we do see milder conditions again for the first half of the following week. So rather than being a long-range forecast, I think we're just taking it half a week at a time. It is ebbing and flowing, really. It's mild, then it's chilly, then it's mild again, and then it'll probably go chilly again. And so, things are on the move again, but in a different way to how they've been for the past 2 or 3 months.
Yes, the feeling that the weather got stuck, that seems to be over now. I mean, the thing about the British weather, as you obviously know, is that it's changeable, is what you can expect. But it was not what we expected, what we experienced over the last couple of weeks. It seemed to be the same thing every day, day after day after day after day, raining and raining and raining and raining.
Yeah, something of a block, yeah. That's the sort of thing that can happen in the UK. We do get weather conditions that are blocked, really. The weather systems can become blocked in the same places, if you like. So that's what we have seen over the winter, yeah, that's quite right. Blocking can occur, of course, in the summer, and it's very nice when it blocks in the summer because the high pressure usually takes control then. That's the high pressure which is stopping any rain bands coming in off the Atlantic, and instead of looking at rain for a few days or weeks, we start to look south for the heat waves. So we do then have some blocking in the sense that we can see some hotter weather coming in from the south, from Spain and Portugal, even North Africa. And that's when we call Spanish plume weather, which is going to bring you severe heat waves. So it's when it's, when it gets really too hot, we do experience these conditions, 38 to 40 degrees in recent years, just for a couple of 3 days. But that's the same sort of pattern. It's a block, but in a different sort of format, really.
And as far as the summer is concerned, I mean, I don't know very much about it. I'm sure you know as much as anybody needs to. So tell us what the effect the El Nino and El Niña will have, and which is going to be relevant this year.
El Nino and La Niña.
Is that it? Right.
Yeah. Well, it's the sort of thing that happens because of a change in the sea temperature off Peru, down off South America. And in normal conditions, you'd have what we generally see, really. I have to say, when you're talking about El Nino, and it's the boy child, that's what it stands for in South American lingo, Spanish or Portuguese or something. Hmm. So El Nino is when you've got cold conditions normally off the Peruvian coast, and then there's a change in the trade winds. The change in the trade winds changes the temperatures. It's impacting the conditions across the southern hemisphere in particular. And the northern hemisphere doesn't get influenced quite the same. So it is much more of a thing for the southern hemisphere, where things are reversed from where they would normally be. But there is a slight impact further north as it crosses the equator. But there's no steadfast rules about how things can change with El Nino. Sometimes you can have much more unsettled weather in the northern hemisphere. You can certainly get less hurricanes, or you can get more hurricanes down in the Caribbean into southeastern parts of the states. But it wouldn't necessarily impact northwestern Europe to the same degree. Obviously, it's something that people are always considering and looking at and researching into. One El Nino, is it the same as the next El Nino? Well, it very rarely is. And it's a whole new science. It's not the sort of thing that was taught about when I first joined the Met Office all those years ago.
Right.
We just took the weather as it was, but these things have become much more sexy, much more things to talk about in more recent years, I think.
Yes, and is there any correlation between what kind of a summer they had in the southern hemisphere and what kind of a summer we will have in the northern?
Well, I would say not. I would say that the two are totally separate. Climate scientists who are studying these things all the time, and they're running their computer models and they're coming up with all sorts of different results, may well have a different view on it. I'm not a climate scientist, but I look at the weather from day to day, week to week, and that's quite complicated enough for me, Nick. So I wouldn't like to say there was any connection whatsoever. I think we are separate hemispheres, and we have got enough to worry about with what comes at us from the west normally.
Right.
And every now and again, we look forward to these heat waves coming up from southern Spain.
Yes, and so in our immediate future, could you give us the forecast as far as you can see?
At the moment, we're looking at a mild spell. Temperature's probably up around 18 degrees. The mildest day will be on Wednesday. There'll be rain in the far west, and some of that rain spills eastwards on Thursday. Then it goes cold for the weekend, so we'll see a touch of frost. The milder weather is knocking on the door at the beginning of next week, so we're going to see higher temperatures again. Later in the week, I think we'll probably see another band of rain coming over. That'll introduce colder conditions, a bit more of an Arctic feel. How long that would last, that's certainly open to question at the moment. Probably not very long. I think we're now coming up to March on Sunday week. Yeah, it'll be a week today. So we've got March to come, and we hope that things are going to improve by then. But my mantra has always been the same. There's always more chance of snow at Easter than there is on Christmas Day, and I'll stick with that one.
Very good to talk to you, John. Thanks so much for that. John Ketley, weather forecaster and broadcaster. Thanks so much, John.
Thank you, Nick.
Cheers. Ta-da.
Bye-bye.
So we're going to take a short break, and then we are going to check in with our US correspondent. You're listening to LBC.
Coming up at 1 on LBC, Henry Reilly.
Reform UK would create an ICE-style agency, but does a party that's topping the opinion polls risk alienating the public on migration? Plus, we'll talk special educational needs in schools.
Henry Reilly. At 1, listen on our free Global Player app or the LBC app.
Get extra support with Immunace multivitamins, with vitamin D, zinc and selenium, which contribute to the normal function of the immune system. Immunace from Vitabiotics, the UK's number one vitamin company. Verification at vitabiotics.com. From Boots, pharmacies and vitabiotics.com.
A Thameslink train is a place where family moments become more peaceful. Where you can spread out and a game of I Spy gets a scenic upgrade, with snacks, stories, and the occasional sheep for a bonus point. Less stress, more yes with kids tickets for £2 at thameslinkrailway.com. Terms apply.
You're really building that business, Josh. That's because you chose to bank with Virgin Money, earning cash back on your supplies, turning expenses into rewards on everything from Sanders to skip hire. He came, he soared, he conquered. Open Virgin Money's M account for business now. UK excludes NI, Channel Islands and Isle of Man. 18 plus. Terms and exclusions apply. Cashback rate of 0.25% backed by the current account switch service. Virgin Money is a trading name of Clydesdale Bank PLC.
Some days it feels like your to-do list just won't quit. When life gets hectic, let Halfords take something off your plate. We're here when you need us, with trusted experts ready to help you tick off MOTs, servicing, tyre fitting and more. So your car's ready for whatever's ahead. So why put it off? Get in touch or drop in today. Book online at Halfords.com or give your local Halfords garage a call and we'll sort it. So you can keep moving with confidence.
Nick Abbott on LBC. Call 0345 6060 973.
So off to America now for the latest from there. David Smith is the Washington Bureau Chief at The Guardian and joins us on the line now. Hello, David.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thanks. So dramatic news from Mar-a-Lago. What do we know about that person that got shot?
Yeah, this is Donald Trump's private estate, of course, in Palm Beach, Florida. And most weekends during the winter, he is there and often goes to play golf. It just so happened this was one weekend when, in fact, he remained in Washington. But in his absence, a man approached the estate, went through the security perimeter, carrying a gun and a fuel can, and he was eventually shot and killed by the Secret Service. He has been named by the Palm Beach County Sheriff as Austin Martin, age 21, from Cameron, North Carolina. You know, we've not seen yet any comment from Trump about this shooting. I think his press secretary was framing it as a third assassination attempt and trying to blame the opposition Democratic Party, because of course it did come after those other incidents in 2024, the shooting that clipped Trump's ear at the rally in Pennsylvania and an intruder on a golf course. But otherwise, you know, so far not much known about this man or what his motive was.
Yes, and yet the regime is already labelling him crazy, you know, communist terrorist maniac, just like they did to those two people that got shot in Minnesota by ICE.
And, that's right, and as in one of those cases in Minnesota, an irony that the fact he's carrying a firearm is seen as beyond the pale and worthy of rebuke, and yet normally it's Republicans who, you know, champion the right of people to carry firearms. Yes. All over America and celebrate the Second Amendment. I think we'll await to hear more in terms of a psychological profile and you know, motive for who this was and you know, why he was at the scene.
Yes, I did not have that on my Trump bingo card, that the Republicans now would be criticizing people for carrying guns.
Exactly, and Donald Trump has forced the Republican Party to surrender many of its principles over the years. Just to take one example, you know, foreign policy. Obviously the Soviet Union was the great foe, and now Trump has cozied up to Russia often, and others too. But no one, I think, thought that he could even attack the Second Amendment, which is really sacred territory for many Republicans. But now suddenly, gun ownership is under question with Trump, and as ever, very few Republicans tend to speak out.
Yes. Well, more are doing so, aren't they? Do you get the feeling that the tide has somewhat changed for Donald Trump, particularly with this Supreme Court ruling against his insane tariffing?
You can certainly make that argument. I mean, I'm always cautious because, as a reporter in Washington, I have written the tide is turning against Trump story many times over the years, and that sort of sense of his grip on the Republican Party is finally weakening. And frankly, anybody who can come back from the January the 6th insurrection and four criminal cases and win the presidency should not be written off. But right now, certainly, yes, you can sort of join the dots and see political trouble for him. The defeat in the Supreme Court on Friday was described by the Wall Street Journal as the worst moment of Trump's presidency so far. Could certainly be seen as the most significant defeat. It was obviously the court's ruling that he did not have the right under these so-called emergency powers to impose these tariffs on trading partners around the world. You know, along with the economic implications of that, it was just a really symbolic rebuke of Trump's authoritarianism, this idea that he could do everything through the executive and sideline Congress and the Supreme Court. You know, this was a moment where the court discovered its spine. And when you add that to a whole bunch of other issues, such as the apparent climb down in Minneapolis and some sluggish economic data and absolutely terrible opinion polling, where his approval rating is, you know, in the 30s, and even his handling of immigration and the economy are in negative numbers. And yes, there are some Republicans speaking out on the Epstein files and other things. It does look pretty bleak and grim for Republicans going into the November midterm elections. But as I said at the beginning, you know, if you take a step back, Trump has seen quite a lot of ups and downs over the years, and he does tend to persist.
Yes, but I think he won the second time after the January the 6th because he is essentially, his supporters have joined a cult. But part of that cult was that the world is being run by a Democrat paedophile ring, and they wanted the details, and the details are in the Epstein files. And Donald Trump seems to have been incredibly reluctant to give his base what they want, which has made them somewhat distance themselves from him. And it's the first time that you can see a crack of light between MAGA and Trump, isn't it?
Yes, I think that's true. There is a different quality to the Epstein files from all these various other scandals, because Trump himself stirred the conspiracy theories, and as you say, that core support really latched on to this idea of a paedophile ring and was trusting Trump to blow it wide open. Again, I think a couple of points that slightly complicate it. One is that, you know, if you look at it from one perspective, Trump is getting off relatively scot-free compared to the former Prince Andrew or former Ambassador Peter Mandelson or other figures in Europe. While there's been these earthquakes there, in the US, you know, you do not hear people calling for Trump to resign, as they are in some cases for Keir Starmer. And you have, you know, apart from Ghislaine Maxwell, you've not seen legal prosecutions either, even of, you know, Trump cabinet member Howard Lutnick, who was caught in a lie over all of this. So he's escaped that same sort of legal reckoning. But on the other hand, yes, we may well see a reckoning at the ballot box in November, because independent voters, you know, Democrats are galvanized by this issue. And then, as you say, I think there are at least some sections of the Trump base, you know, not all of them, but certainly some, who feel disappointed and betrayed by this. And, you know, they won't necessarily vote against Trump, but they will just stay home and not vote for his party.
Yes, as low as Trump's polling is, I think the only other president who got polling around that level was him the first time around. I think he's, by a long chalk, the least popular president in the history of America. I think that that's right. But go on.
Yes, I think that is right. There was some recent polling showing that people are already getting nostalgic for Joe Biden and want him back, and he was a bit more popular. And of course, on Tuesday, Trump delivers his State of the Union address, where he'll be trying to counter some of those critics. It is a bit of a malaise right now. And as you mentioned, that first term polling, of course, that did result in Republicans losing the House of Representatives in the midterm elections. Mm. So all the omens are bad for him there.
Yes. And finally, there was a Submariner in Greenland on a US submarine who became ill and was, as you would expect, taken to hospital and treated for free by the medics in Greenland. And Donald Trump got wind of it and and he decided to send a hospital boat from Louisiana, I think, which is about as far away from Greenland as you can get while still being in America. So what's the story there?
Yeah, and you have to assume American taxpayers not very impressed by that. I think the Louisiana link becomes because it's the governor of Louisiana, Jeff Landry, who is supposedly his Greenland envoy. And so Trump said on social media, send a hospital boat there to take care of the many people who are sick and are not being taken care of there. Mm. And of course, the Prime Minister of Greenland says that will be no thanks from us.
Yes.
And no need for this hospital boat. But it's a bizarre gesture. And Trump, I guess, making sure that Greenland remains in the headlines.
Yeah, I think that both, because America only has two hospital boats, and they're both in for repairs, so they're not available to sail anyway.
Right, indeed, and I suspect Trump had not thought that through, and that makes it quite worrying that at the very same moment he has amassed this kind of vast armada,
yes,
near Iran for a potential military strike there. So yeah, it makes you wonder what else has he not thought through to its logical conclusion.
My favourite quote of the week so far is from the Prime Minister of Greenland, who said no thanks, but he also said to Donald Trump, but please talk to us instead of just making more or less random statements on social media. Well, we can but hope.
And it does remind you, people in Greenland said, of course, they would not want to give up Danish healthcare in favour of American healthcare, which is notoriously patchy.
Well, yes, unless you've got a lot of money. David, very good to talk to you. Thanks for that. David Smith, Washington Bureau Chief at The Guardian. Now, if you missed any of today's show, all my shows on Friday and Saturday, then you can listen back on Global Player or the new LBC app, on which you can also stay up to date with the latest news, videos, opinion, and so on. You can get them both. They are free from your app store now. I'll be back Friday, Saturday, Sunday night at 10. Coming up at 4, it's Ian Payne. But first, here's Henry Reilly.
Thank you very much, Nick. Good morning. Henry Reilly in for Richard Spur this morning on LBC. Coming up,
if you are in this country illegally right now and you are watching this, I want to be crystal clear. As Reform's Home Secretary, I will ensure that you are deported from these lands.
Zia Youssef, in a major speech today, Reform UK will create an ICE-style agency dedicated to deporting 6,000 people a week. Does the party topping the opinion polls really speak for you? Plus,
schools can better cater for children much more quickly, specialist support, much more support. Every parent will fight for their children.
Sir Keir Starmer says no child with special needs will be left behind. What's been the challenges and barriers you or your children have faced due to having a learning disability? And,
well, this is John Barron, and this is the worst decision you've ever had in your life, practically. This is a terrible decision, and you have Hakeem Jeffries, who, he's a dope.
A call from John Barron in Virginia to US network C-SPAN. Viewers are saying, it sounds like someone familiar.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 1 o'clock. Government plans to increase funding and support for children with special educational needs and disabilities are being welcomed broadly by unions. Today's white paper, which will be presented to Parliament, is due to include a £4 billion package to make schools more inclusive. But the inequality lecturer, Dr. Lisa McKenzie, has been telling LBC white papers can't fix everything.
I'm glad that more money is going to go into schools and it's going to start to address perhaps the educational inequalities. They might have a better education, they might have better GCSEs, but how is that going to change when the part of the country that you live in has been deprived over many, many years.
Investigations are continuing after an armed man was shot dead at President Trump's Mar-a-Lago residence in Florida. The suspect, named as Austin Tucker Martin, had been reported missing by his family and had travelled from North Carolina. Reform UK says it will impose a visa freeze on Pakistan, Afghanistan and Syria if they won't take back illegal immigrants. The party's new Home Affairs spokesman is expected to make an announcement concerning people with no legal right to stay in the UK. More now from LBC's George Ellison.
Zia Yusuf is due to say Reform's new policy will also apply to Eritrea, Sudan and Somalia during a speech scheduled for tomorrow in Dover. It's expected to focus on what are being called immigration, policing, national security frameworks and cultural preservation. Reform also say costings will be set out during the event. Home Secretary Shabana Mahmood has already threatened to block UK visas for people from some African countries if they don't cooperate over deportees.
And there'll be more on this during the next hour with Henry Riley here on LBC. Research is suggesting the number of job vacancies in the UK has fallen to a five-year low. One of the leading employment websites says they reduced by 3% last month. And state of emergency orders have been issued in the eastern United States following predictions of 2 feet of snow. They apply to New York, New Jersey, Connecticut and Massachusetts. Mikey Sherrill is the governor of New Jersey.
Blizzard warnings are in effect along coastal New Jersey for the first time since 2022. Across New Jersey, we